Pennsylvania, or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. I'm going to talk with our good friend Richard Eskow from the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. I'm going to talk about Romney, Bain Capital. I'm loving the fact that the righties are going after Romney for doing what they set up for him to do. The whole deregulation, the whole do away with Glass-Steagall, the whole take controls off of capital. Tear down borders for capital. Let capital run amok. Let it do what it does best, which is create more capital for the capitalists. Pretty simple. That's the basic definition of capitalism. Use your money to make more money. It's not about making a better society. If that happens, and this is the part that the capitalists don't want you to get, it's about making money. It's not about making a better society. And if that happens, that's just a consequence of them making more money. Now, back in the old days when we had an opportunity to say, whoa, we're going to let you make money, a lot of it, tons of it, you'll be fine, you'll never have to do an honest day's work, an honest day's labor in your life, those hands will never be calloused. But you're going to have to show why whatever business, whatever corporation that you're going to start is going to benefit the community. They used to be called charters, something I think we should be going back to. So it'll be interesting to talk to Richard from the Campaign for America's Future. Also, Christy Setzer is going to be here from the U.S. Chamber Watch. Tom Donahue, the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, coming out against Richard Cordry, really against any regulation. So we're going to take a look at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which I got to be honest, I think is a terrorist group. I'm pretty upfront about that. I think they should be looked at in that light. They are not your local Chamber of Commerce. They're not the people who plant flowers in the walkway. They're not the people who spruce up Main Street to bring in more business. They're not doing that at all. They don't represent those businesses. In fact, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, or I should say the International Chamber of Commerce, because they're not only here, they're all across the globe. In fact, one of the better groups, if you want to take jobs overseas, they're going to act as that conduit to help grease the wheel so you can move faster out of the country. Again, I don't know that there's much U.S. interest there, so we should just call them the International Chamber of Commerce, because it's about international investment for them. So it'll be interesting to talk to her about what's going on there. Also, Peter Linebaugh, he's a professor of history at the University of Toledo, the author of the book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. Going to have him on the program talking about the piece of legislation that they want to push through in New Hampshire. Which I guess three of the representatives came forth with this idea that every piece of legislation that goes through the New Hampshire legislature, before it can be introduced, it has to has to have its origins in the Magna Carta. Now, I guess that's just basic Republican one-upsmanship, because in the U.S. House, they wanted to pass through a piece of legislation that said every bill had to be certified and had to find its origins in the U.S. Constitution. Well, the Republicans up in New Hampshire, they want to go a little further. They want to go back to the Magna Carta. So, very interesting. Also today, we're going to play a couple of the interviews that we recorded while in New Hampshire, a couple of them that I thought were interesting. One, a guy named Jimmy Tingle. He's a presidential comedian. He's running for president as a joke. Going to tell you right up front, funny guy. We're actually thinking about having some kind of event before the Pennsylvania primaries where we can bring Jimmy Tingle into the area, into Scranton, into the Harrisburg area, so that we can have a couple of events, you know, to kind of lighten up the primary season, make it a little exciting, and get people out and involved and active and educated and engaged in all those wonderful things that I think are really good things about politics. And you look at what happened up in New Hampshire, I wish that could happen in every state, where you have people going out to the coffee shops and to the restaurants and to the parks or wherever, having conversations, actually talking to people. So we're going to play that interview, and also going to play the interview I did with Rick Tyler. He is a former Newt Gingrich press secretary. Now he's a shill for some front group, and the name eludes me off the top of my head. But they bought the movie King of Bane, kingofbane.com, if you want to watch the anti-Romney movie that the Gingrich front group purchased from somebody else. It's all kind of twisted, but at the end of it, it's Gingrich's guy who's bought this movie to attack Romney. So that's an interesting interview. Stick around for that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So, I'm waiting for the teabaggers to go nuts. The president yesterday asked Congress to raise the debt ceiling by another $1.2 trillion, up to $16.4 trillion. Now, the hope is that the agreement that they made, and this is going to be something interesting over the next 15 days, because he has to ask for it formally, which he's done in a letter to both the House and the Senate. 15 days, Congress has to oppose it. So in the next 15 days, we'll see if the Republicans are good on their word, because this is part of the agreement they made back the last time they held us hostage. The last time that we went to the edge, and in fact, the reason that our credit rating dropped is because they did take us to the edge. And we looked over the edge, and I don't know that we liked what we saw, because our debt, our credit rating actually went down, and our interest went up a little bit, not like in other countries, but it popped up a little bit. And what's that mean? That means you and I pay more for the debt that they ran up. And it's wars. It's tax cuts for the very wealthy. It's a prescription drug bill that says, hey, we're Americans, we pay retail. That's a good portion of the debt, not to mention the Reagan debt. When we talk about all this money, people seem to think that we only went into debt when Obama came into office. Not true. Think of all the massive debt that Republicans have run up over the last couple of presidencies. It's mind-blowing. I mean, there's only been one president who's had a balanced budget. That was Clinton for 2 years. And I remember, during those years leading up to 2000, when Bush came in and gave it all away, getting people like Greenspan saying, I don't know what we're going to do. We're going into uncharted waters. We're going to be debt free. We don't know how, economically, we don't know how to act. And that hope, that optimism, that thought process didn't last long, because in came Shrub and the handouts that followed, and the wars and the drug bill and all of those other things. So again, when you think about this debt, everyone says, oh, it's the Obama debt. A small portion, actually. Because no matter who was president in 2009, you were going to see a $1.2 trillion deficit, no matter who it was. But that's a discussion that nobody really, really wants to have in the mainstream media, because it's too close to the facts. Again, we might need truth vigilantes. You know, hopefully the New York Times has heard the word loud and clear. Yes, we want to be reported to. We don't want to be lied to. Tell us the truth. We can handle it. We can. We're big boys and girls. We're able to do these things because, you know, we're adults. Or no. You know, there's some who, you know,
you can't handle the truth.
Well, you know, there's some who think that. I think we can. I think we're big boys and girls. We can handle the truth. I don't know if you saw this today. The president has said that he wants to elevate the Small Business Administration to a cabinet level position. So that, you know, you can boost small businesses, streamline government. You know, this is something the Republicans should be all in favor of. But you know how this is going to play with the righties. He's trying to consolidate power. In fact, he's trying to combine six government offices into one. Again, this is part of, you know, kind of what they should be in favor of, this whole synergy. I'm not quite sure how I feel about it yet. I like the idea of being able to get ideas out and to get small businesses up and running quickly. But I'm not so thrilled with the idea of putting so much power in the hands of one agency. His intention also is to put the Trade and Department of Commerce also into one. So, you know, reorganizing these six trade and commerce agencies and all of these into one gives that office a lot of power. Now, it's going to be a cabinet level position, so, you know, maybe it will have some teeth. And maybe, I guess the question becomes, if we do that, will this restructuring, will it do anything to help us protect ourselves? Will it help us lower our trade deficit? Will it mean trade enforcement? Will we not have to rely on the U.S. steel workers to file trade cases with the WTO? Will it be they're not going to have to do all the legwork and hand it over? See, because you think government should be the one doing this. But unfortunately not. So the question is, once we put all this together, will we see better enforcement? Will we see a concerted effort to lower our trade deficit? Because the trade deficit numbers are out. Again, you know, another high year, increased again. In November, it was $47.8 billion trade deficit in goods and services with the rest of the world. That's up from 43.3 in October. Now, our deficit with China, maybe a good thing with China. It dropped a little bit down to just about $27 billion, down from just over $28 billion. But here's the thing. We're still on pace to break records. We're continually getting worse. The trade deficit with China continually getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And look, maybe if this maybe this cabinet position, who knows? Maybe they will start to put a focus on this. Maybe they will start to think about, honestly, think about country first. Because I've heard that slogan 1,000 times. We need to talk about country first, country first, country first. And I'm with you. Let's think about country first. But in more than just sloganing, how about in our trade policy? And, you know, I think about the auto industry quite often. Because there was a time in this country where the auto industry, how GM went, the U.S. went. If we had big manufacturing, auto plants, we had all those feeder jobs that fed into it. We were a manufacturing powerhouse. We were this close. We were so close to losing that entire industry. And this president, you got to give him credit, took the political heat, took the beating from the radical right, because they wanted it to go away. They wanted it to be neutered. They wanted it to go in bankruptcy. And, you know, Zach Wamp said it himself.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Let them learn the lesson the hard way. Let them fail. Let those workers fail. And it wasn't like they bailed them out. They gave them a loan that was paid back. And now you see that there's a plan. The plan is the American automakers, they're going to hire thousands of workers in the coming year because their sales continue to rebound. Ford and Chrysler announced that they're going to add a total of 6,000 factory workers in Michigan, Kentucky, and Illinois. That will bring their total number of jobs to about $650,000 in the coming year. There are 650,000 employees in the coming year. That, my friends, is why. That is why they loan the auto companies money. Keep those people employed. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this with Richard Escow from the Campaign for America's Future. Back after this.
USA is drowning in traps and lies. Save the USA and resume the size of time. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job and join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The new year is off to an old start. Workers rallying at state houses to defend their rights. Jesse Russell has more.
2012 is starting off much like 2011 with images of concerned citizens filling state houses. This year, instead of the images starting in Wisconsin, they're starting in Indiana, where workers are opposing a Republican plan to turn the state into a so-called right-to-work state. The legislation would ban businesses and unions from writing contracts that would require employees to pay dues to the unions that represent them. Last week, members of the NFL Players Association challenged legislators to vote against the legislation, as they considered it an attack on workers. This week saw Oklahomans standing with their Indiana counterparts detailing how right to work has had a negative impact on their state. Jesse Isbell is an Oklahoma worker.
There is no anecdotal or empirical evidence that right to work has benefited Oklahoma state economy in any way. The truth is it has driven down wages.
Oklahoma was the 22nd state to pass the legislation. Since that legislation passed, manufacturing jobs continue to move to Mexico and overseas. The most recent company to pack up was Bridgestone Tire, where Isbell was an employee of 36 years.
When you think of medical helicopter pilots, you may not immediately think union. But Dan McDade is a MedFlight chopper pilot who is also president of OPEIU Local 109, affiliated with the Professional Helicopter Pilots Association. This is the most challenging time of year for pilots who must keep an irregular schedule.
Pager, the tones can go off at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, and usually, you know, like 2 and 3 in the morning when we have to go fly. That's kind of like the most dangerous time, only because it's hard to get any kind of a sleep cycle where we shift from days to nights and things like that. So, and you're on for 12 hours at a time. So we do have crew rest issues.
McDade says unionized pilots have a voice on the job, a critical voice when it comes to safety.
The guys doing the job needed to be a factor in controlling their safety. Most of the safety improvements that have happened because of the unions that have brought those safety changes and made them happen. If a federal regulation needs to happen, it is not usually the company that is lobbying Congress to make it happen. Usually it's the unions.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO and by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Let my daddy come on, Neil, how it works when he come home from World War II. How the yard's just a scrap and rubble. He said them big boys did what in their cutting did. Yeah, these mills, they built the tanks and bombs that won this country's war. We sent our sons to Korea and Vietnam. Now we're wondering what they were dying.
Well, I guess the question then you could ask then, you know, if, you know, the big boys back then did what Hitler couldn't do, well, did Romney? Think of all of the manufacturing capacity that the the banes of the world destroyed in this country. You know, I remember the 80s and 90s, the corporate raiding that went on, and the profitable companies that were sucked dry, the pension funds that were raided, and all of the people who were put out on the unemployment line. Why? So people like Romney could have just a little more. Have their seventh or eighth house, or double or maybe quadruple the size of one of their homes. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So, interesting story. CNBC reported that Obama, and how dare he do this, used Romney's Bain company to advise him on the auto bailout. And then they had to walk back from it because it wasn't Romney's firm. It was a different one. It was Bain Consulting. But never mind with your facts. It makes for a good story because if you can make Romney and Obama the same, it's now not an issue. Which is what they were going for, and they got smacked back, and good for them. Anyway, I've got Richard Eskow on the phone. Campaign for America's Future has a great piece over at ourfuture.org. Bain Capitalism, Mitch Frankenstein is a politically created monster. Wonderfully written piece. Richard, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, good to be here, Rick.
You know, I look at all this, and what I'm delighting in is the fact that it's the Republicans who are going after Romney. It's the right basically eating themselves.
Well, you know it is, and that's because at the end of the day, when they've got to go out and get votes, they know that people are really pissed off about all of this, so that's what they say in order to get the votes. So for a change, we've got Republicans repeating our talking points instead of guys who are supposed to be on our side repeating their talking points, and we ought to keep that up. We ought to make sure that keeps happening.
Well, I want to keep Newt Gingrich in the race as long as possible. In fact, send him a couple of bucks to keep him going. But what's interesting to me is it's the situation that made Bain Capital possible, that made Romney's group possible, are the exact policies that the right has pursued for 30, 40 years and beyond.
Well, that's right. You know, it's so interesting when people say, well, you know, if you criticize Bain Capital, you're criticizing capitalism. No, Bain Capital got successful. By the way, it kind of sucked wind there for 2 or 3 years until it learned how to take advantage of the rules. It got successful because politicians in Washington and elsewhere, but mostly Washington, made it possible for it to be successful. It gave them cushy tax deals, it bent the regulations, it bent the rules, it made money available to them right and left, and let the banks deregulate. Because, you know, these guys don't, Bain Capital, Mitt Romney, they don't put their own money into a business, they put other people's money in. So really, the government let them get rich off of other people's money. A lot of times that was your money in mine deposited in the bank or your pension fund in mine that they were playing around with. And then when those banks, because they were borrowing themselves to do it, when they hit the wall, we bailed them out with our money again, but Mitt got his $250 million out of it.
Yep, and, you know, I look at this, and, you know, you brought up other people's money, and I remember it just popped into my head, the Danny DeVito movie back in the 90s that pretty much walked through this entire scenario that Bain Capital did. They went into, you know, a company was pretty profitable. They were the anchor of the little town. They employed a good number of the people. Had a huge pension fund, and in came the raiders. Sucked the pension fund dry and cut all those people out in the street just so they could have a little bit more.
Right. No, that's what this is all about. And to do it quickly, I always think of, when I think of companies like Bain Capital, I think of the movie Independence Day, you know, the big saucers that would come and, like, suck everything out of the planet and then move on. That's the business model, and they don't even make the flying saucers themselves. We make the flying saucers by making the laws and the rules that let them do it. So, you know, the point I was trying to make in writing that piece is government, that is to say us, made Bain Capital and companies like it, so we can unmake companies like Bain Capital. We can change the rules to say, you don't get these tax breaks if you're not creating jobs. You don't get, you know, Mitt Romney gets to earn $250 billion at a 15% tax rate when you and I and everybody else who works for a living pays so much more than that. No, you don't get to do that anymore. You know, the whole point to begin with was to give a tax base so that people invested and created jobs, not to give a tax break so that people could destroy jobs or send them overseas. So we ought to change the rules, and as far as I'm concerned, put these companies out of business.
No, I'm right there with you. You know, and I look at this, and I remember one of Romney's partners came out, and I forget what his name is. I'm sure you probably remember. But he said, look, I didn't know we were in the business of creating jobs. I thought we were making money.
Well, see, that's a point I made too, you know, is that because, you know, I spent a little time sort of on the edge of that world, and I know that those guys would say, hey, it's not called Bain employment, is it? It's called Bain capital.
Right.
Our job is to make money, not to create jobs. And that's right, because, you know, if you set up the rules so that you can make money the way they make money, you can bet that if Mitt Romney weren't around, some other guy would be doing it because the money's too good. So the problem is, you know, whatever you think of Mitt, and for me it's not all that much, but the problem isn't really Mitt. The problem is the system that allows Mitt to make money for nothing, as the old song says.
Yeah, well, I had several of those conversations. Well, if it wasn't him, it would be someone else. And I would ask the question, isn't there something wrong with the system then? You know, and what I find interesting is the Limbaughs and all the right ring, you know, the mega rich megaphones are out there defending what he's done. And I'm saying, shouldn't we be talking about what capitalism really is? And it's the capitalists who have the money that they've taken from someone else making more money, not creating jobs, not looking for a better society, but making more money. That's what capitalism to me is. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. The guys like Rusty Limbaugh, you know, he was born rich into a rich Republican family. So yeah, of course he thinks that way. And he's, you know, these guys are all Republican hacks and the party's picked Romney, so they're going to defend him no matter what he does. But the point is, you know, you have a system that, I think of like It's a Wonderful Life, you know, Jimmy Stewart, a banker who like he lived in his community. If somebody wanted to start a good business, maybe he even took a little bit of a chance and gambled a little money because he really believed in them and wanted to help his community. You know, that was the way it used to be, but now we've changed the rules around so much that guys like Romney can make a lot of money by buying up Jimmy Stewart's bank, shutting down all the businesses, boarding up Main Street, ruining the community, and then moving on to do it somewhere else.
Yeah, and to me, the answer really lies in our tax code and in the regulations that we've stripped away. I look at Glass-Steagall being something I wish we could go back to, but also a relatively high tax rate so that the incentive isn't as great to go and do what they've been doing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you take this whole notion of capital gains and investment income. You know, Republicans and a lot of Democrats, too, but they keep telling us, well, we keep these rates low because that makes people invest, and that creates jobs. Well, okay, then how about if we say your rate's really high unless you've created jobs? You know, in other words, that's a government decision to say we're going to give you a tax break for creating jobs. Well, if we're going to do it, then show me you created the jobs, and maybe we can talk. But until then, hey, the times that this country was the greatest and the healthiest, the top tax rate was way higher than it is now.
91%.
91, when Rick Perry says, you know, I miss the America that existed when I was growing up in the 50s, I say, well, you know what, son, that was the America where the top tax rate was 91%, and you guys are bitching about taking it from 35 to 39.5.
Yep.
So you don't really miss it, you just say you miss it.
Well, not to mention just that. I mean, the corporations were paying considerably higher taxes. They were paying at least a third of the tax revenues that came into the government. Now it's below 7%, and they're still complaining that they're taxed too high.
You know, I mean, if you read some of the books about the bank crisis, those bankers expected they were going to be broken up, taken over, fired, which is what should have happened.
Absolutely.
But give them a year or two, once they get secure again, then they start whining again. And so that's what they're doing now. And why wouldn't they whine? Because every time they whine, everybody says, oh, we can't upset them, so we better let them keep paying 15% while the cop on the beat and the nurse in the hospital is paying 28 or 30. So, yeah, of course they're going to whine. One, because a lot of them are just that kind of person. And two, because, you know, it's good money for them to keep whining.
And we've continually bailed them out every time they get into trouble. We've socialized the risk and privatized the profit. And they're used to that. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Richard Eskow from the Campaign for America's Future. The piece, Bain Capitalism, Mitt's Frankenstein is a politically created monster. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Richard Eskow's name. You know, the other day, were you as upset as I was when Romney was asked about talking about income inequality, and he said it was something that should be talked about in quiet rooms?
Yeah, it's like, don't upset the children.
Yeah.
You know, it's treating the American people like children. You know, it's, but you know what? That's the psychology of, in a way, he's only more honest than a lot of people all over Washington and elsewhere, because when you get right down to it, they kept it secret, for example, that the Fed was making all this money available to the banks and that the banks were getting all this secret help back in 2008. Same psychology, which is if the public really knows how unfair and screwed up our system is, they'll be upset and that could hurt the stock market or whatever. So really their attitude is, no, no, I'll have lunch with the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve and maybe we'll chat about this here or there. But the rest of you common folk, no, no, no. We don't talk to you about that kind of thing. That's been the idea for too long, and it's pathetic. It's not democracy.
Well, I think Jack Nicholson said it best.
You can't handle the truth!
Well, exactly. Well, that's exactly right. And you know what? I think the answer is we need a little less Jack Nicholson-style politics and a little more just telling the people what's going on, because you know what they know. I mean, that's why, whether it's Occupy Wall Street or anything else, that's Madison. The reason why these things catch on is that people aren't stupid. You can tell me we have this equitable, just, socially mobile society where anyone can, you know, grow up to be president or whatever, but I didn't just fall off the truck. I can see how my family's doing next to how the Romney family is doing. I can see who's got a job and who doesn't. I mean, you know, we know what time it is. So when somebody comes along and finally says what people know, hey, this system is unfair, it's rigged, yeah, people respond to that because they're not stupid.
At least I hope not. Did you see Nikki Haley on TV last night talking about we shouldn't hold Mitt accountable for his claim of 100,000 jobs that he created? And the other part of this is should we be looking at the 100,000 jobs that he's claiming to have created at Staples and Sports Authority and Domino's? Are those the kind of jobs we want to have in the 21st century?
Well, I mean, I think sure any job is a good job, but. I think they're not the only kinds of jobs we want to have. And think about it. A job at Staples or Domino's is the only kind of job you can't outsource, isn't it? Because you can't have a guy in India delivering your pizza to your house in a half hour. You know, so Domino's, you got to work here. Service jobs, they got to happen here. Retail jobs, they got to happen here until they put it all online. So, you know, I mean, that's the only job they want to have in this country. And you also got to ask yourself, okay, Staples is doing pretty well. The pizza place is doing pretty well. But would they have done pretty well if Bain Capital didn't exist? They might even be doing better because they wouldn't be paying all these management fees. So, you know, I haven't really looked at that, but that's a question we got to ask, you know. Are they really creating jobs or just getting rich off of jobs they would have been there anyway? Because I don't know about you, but I need office supplies and I eat pizza whether Bain Capital's involved or not.
Good point. But, you know, the one exception I'll make with you is I don't know that they're good jobs. I know they can be good jobs. I know my grandmother back in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s had a good union job working at a small department store. You know, I've said it a number of times. In 1985, she was making $8 an hour with full benefits, health care, eye, dental, 6 weeks vacation, retirement, defined benefit. They don't get that today, 27 years later.
Well, that's right. And you know what? If they did, they'd have more money to spend on pizza, wouldn't they? And if they got more money to spend on pizza, then maybe you don't need a Bain Capital out there cutting jobs and doing all that. Maybe somebody in the community says, hey, you know, I like making pizza. I'd like to open a little pizza place. Maybe we get back to a little bit more of the small businesses that we really want in this country.
Would love that. We try and use the small local guy as often as we can. We try and steer away from the chains. So my last question for you then is what do we need to do to turn this around? We've realized it's not the Romney, but if it weren't him, it'd be someone else. How do we change this system, and will this continue into the election cycle?
Well, you know, I hope it does. I'll tell you why, because the more we have this debate in the next year, then the more, you know, we're really going to call on the guys who are, you know, say they're on our side to deliver on it. And hopefully they will, because to me, I think you've got to do a couple of things. Like you were saying, you've got to change the tax code. You don't get a tax break if you don't create a job, and you certainly don't get a tax break for outsourcing my job overseas or just firing people. So that's number one, change the tax code, change the tax rates, change the banking rules so that banks can't keep flipping money over to the Bain Capitals of the world to destroy jobs, knowing that if they over-leverage themselves to do it, we'll bail them out. And you know what, the last thing is, you know, and I'm going to mention this just in passing, whatever happened to shame? you know, a guy like Mitt Romney ought to be embarrassed to be running for president, because with his record, people ought to be saying, you know, shame on that guy for firing all those people. That I think that's the society we got to get back to, a society where it's shameful to do that kind of thing.
Do you know why he has no shame? Because he doesn't live in my neighborhood. He's never going to have to look me in the face.
Right.
That's part of the problem. We hear, and I talked about this yesterday, we hear them talk about this being a classless society, yet they keep talking about this thing called the middle class. But the reality is we live in completely different worlds. They fly in private airports, play golf on private courses, live in gated communities. They don't deal with we, the rabble, anymore, so they have no shame.
Well, you know, it's like I love these guys who are always saying, you know, you shouldn't talk about class warfare. We don't have classes. That's like the guy who's sticking me up saying, you shouldn't yell, stop thief. There's no robbery going on around here. You know, it's highway robbery, plain and simple. And by the way, you'll never have Chris Wallace or any of those guys asking Mitt Romney, don't you feel ashamed of yourself? Walter Cronkite might have done it, but these guys never will. So we need that, too.
Well, they're in the same income bracket.
Well, that's true.
I mean, you look at these mega-rich megaphone guys. They don't want to give up that cushy, high-paying gig.
And they're connected to they got a hedge fund working for them, too. You
Absolutely.
Know that, too.
Absolutely. Richard Eskow, always great to talk with you. Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org. Bain Capitalism, the piece. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Richard's name. Thanks so much, Richard.
You bet.
Have a
always
great weekend.
A pleasure. Bye.
I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
And they're talking in the town square, in the town, shouting, talking everywhere. They're talking in the sky, but all their words of wisdom won't make you go away. And baby, cold, back to down, and nothing left to say.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Bars can get in legal trouble when they overserve patrons who then get a DUI citation. But what about retail outfits that contribute to SUI, shopping under the influence? Luxury stores, art galleries, and such have long used booze to stimulate sales. They pour free wine and other libations for their high-end customers, hoping that a lubricated shopper will be less guarded and more willing to reach for that platinum card. But the New York Times reports that the tactic of getting shoppers buzzed has now gone mass market, especially among online retailers. As one of them gleefully put it, post-bar, inhibitions can be impacted, and that can cause shopping and hopefully healthy impulse buying. Great. Our society has advanced from alcohol-induced sex to alcohol-induced consumerism. In either case, the morning after can be a downer. Take the guy who quaffed a tub of beer one night. He stumbled home in a stupor and, stupidly, went online. When he awoke, he learned that he had bought a $10,000 motorcycle tour of New Zealand. Internet retailers say there's been a boom in night traffic. Ask if boozy buying splurges might be sparking the increase? An eBay executive exclaimed, "Absolutely!" noting that eBay's busiest sales period in every time zone is 6:30 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. He happily summed up the reason for this. When people get home from work in the evening, it's decompression time. The consumer's in a good mood. This is Jim Hightower saying, Barack Obama should jump on this. We're told that to get America's economy moving again, consumers need to buy more stuff. Forget trying to pass a stimulus package or a jobs program. To stimulate, inebriate. Just send everyone a credit card, a book of drink coupons, and a list of late-night online marketers.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP. Trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you. What a wonderful world this would be.
Yes, it would be a wonderful world if we could just, well, lie all the time. That would be such a wonderful world. We could just make stuff up, and there were no truth vigilantes out there. The mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media would just be the stenographers that they've become over the last several years, especially during the Bush years. It was all about, oh, we got to get access to the White House because maybe the White House will do our job for us. Because they did an awful lot of that, if you remember. They prepackaged videos, and they did whole stories like they were actually done by the news agencies. Oh, what a wonderful world it would be. And we wouldn't have to worry about going to school. Who needs school? I love Santorum. When we were up in New Hampshire, he said some really dumb thing like...
As I was saying earlier today, the President of the United States came out and said, under my administration, every child should go to college. What elitist snobbery out of this man?
Yes, elitist snobbery. Because we want you to be stupid. And then he's on the stump in South Carolina. Today, in fact. And I can't wait to go through this whole thing and cut out all the clips, because there was just so much insanity in today's stump speech from South Carolina. But this one caught my attention. He's talking about Romney. He's talking about capitalism. He's, I'm all in favor of capitalism, blah, 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 blah. And he gets to the part where he says, he's talking about Romney as kind of your boss. He says, it doesn't necessarily mean that you want your boss running for president, right? And he follows it up with, and I understand the shot at Romney. Then he follows it up with, and he says, and that ability to communicate to voters, that's what we need to win this election. And immediately I started thinking about the whole right-wing anti-worker agenda. He gets it. I think Santorum understands how bad his party is screwed when it comes to workers' rights, how badly they hate workers. He's telling you, the boss and the voter, Romney and the voter, just like the boss-worker relationship, on two entirely different levels. He's admitting you're not on the same level as your boss. This is not an equal relationship. Your opinion doesn't matter. Your thoughts don't matter. You do as you're told. That's conservative world. And I find it hysterical that Romney would say that. Well, that ability to communicate to the voter, that's what we need to win. That guy who's your boss, you can't talk to him because he's your boss. And I would say, well, this is exactly why you need to have a union, so that you have the ability to be on a semi-level plane, to where your voice actually does matter, which is why we have a constitution. See, we have a contract with our nation. These are my rights. This is it, all laid out. This is how things go. These are the rules we all agree upon. You need to start thinking about these stuff a little bit differently. But that's conservative world. And you look at the fact that right now there are more people over the age of 85 working than ever before. I mean, the Labor Department just came out with these numbers. There are more people over 55 right now in the workforce than ever before. And it makes me think about Santorum. His story about his grandfather working, he worked in the mines till he was 72 years old, and he left to get away from the communists, and he left to get away from socialism, and he wanted to be free. So I found it interesting that this Italian magazine, OGGI, you figure out how it's pronounced, went and talked to one of his relatives, an 83-year-old woman, Maria Malcarni Santorum, who is, I guess Santorum is her husband's cousin, or her late husband's cousin. And she goes into this discussion about, she doesn't quite understand how Tricky Ricky got to be so extreme. Because the family, as she tells the story, were red communists. To their core, she says. She writes, on the other side of the ocean, it's like his family here doesn't exist. Instead, he draws crowds as the head of the ultra-conservative faction of the Republican Party against divorce, gay marriage, abortion, and immigration. Yet, Grandpa, the one who worked until he was 72 in the mine, left Italy not because he was running from socialism or he was running from fascism. He was a red communist, somebody who here, years later, the Republican Party would have crucified. So I find it interesting, but on a certain level. She also says there are Santorums that would roll over in their graves to hear him speak, to hear his rhetoric. But I started thinking about this. I go, you know, it's amazing that you would be able to turn away from your history. It's interesting to me that you're going to make up this past to fit your political needs. And I go, yeah, but that is the Republican way. You know, you stop and you think about every one of these right-wing anti-worker politicians who are out there, John Kasich in Ohio, Pat Toomey here, Tricky Ricky, people who are union members who now have turned their back on the very thing that gave them an advantage in life. And it makes sense to me. It's their mentality. It's, I've got mine, the heck with you. I'm going to get as much for me as I can possibly get, and the heck with you. You know, she talks about when Tricky Ricky went over in 1985 during a law internship in Florence. I wonder if that was while he was working for Brightbill. Or I just throw that out there. He also went back in 86 and in 89, and she said, oh, he just loved our culture. He loved our cuisine. Bought his wife a big Italian cookbook. But at the end of it, it shows the hypocrisy. Because as she said, Grandpa wasn't running from that. Grandpa was an extremely liberal man. And he understood right away. She also said he was an anti-fascist to the extreme. And the political climate in 1925 was stifling, so he left for America. A few years, he returned to Italy with his wife and children, including Aldo, which is Rick's father, who passed away last year. She says it's a shame he won't have the joy of seeing his son's success in his bid for the White House. This was a very liberal family. But you've got Tricky using it for his own aims. And right when he came out with that story, my gut instinct was that exactly. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, spider brains. The brains of tiny spiders are so large they fill their body cavities and overflow into their legs.
Researchers at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama measured the central nervous systems of 9 species of spiders, from rainforest giants to spiders smaller than the head of a pin. As the spiders get smaller, their brains get proportionally bigger, filling up more and more of their body cavities.
The researchers said that the smaller the animal, the more it has to invest in its brain power in order to be able to perform fairly complex behaviors, like, in the case of spiders, weaving a web.
They discovered that the central nervous systems of the smallest spiders fill up almost 80% of their total body cavity, including about 25% of their legs.
Some of the tiniest immature baby spiders even have deformed, bulging bodies. That bulge contains excess brain. Adults of the same species don't bulge.
Brain cells use a lot of energy, so small spiders probably convert much of the food they consume into brain power. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. For more on this story, come to earthsky.org and search on the words spider brains. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. A new study out from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. You know, you keep hearing the righties talk about, we've got to repeal Obamacare. We've got to go back to the good old pay or die system. Got to go back to the rescission and pre-existing conditions. Because, you know, you five-year-old who had cancer, you lived a bad life. You made bad decisions. So we're going to make you suffer. Those folks, they want to take us back to the good old days of no health insurance for you. This Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has found that if we go back and we repeal Obamacare, or at least the individual mandate part of it, we could see premium increases of at least 25% and a skyrocketing of government spending on uncompensated care. Because you hear the righties talk about this all the time. We have a national health care system. You just go to the emergency room, and they have to take care of you. And I was thinking about this the other day as I was having this discussion with the doctor I had an appointment with, this idea of, well, we already have national health care. And you know, I said at the beginning when I walked into your office, I had to pay. I had to show my insurance card, pay my deductible, my copay, even before you would even say hello to me. So how is it that someone who doesn't have insurance is going to be able to come and see you? He goes, well, blah, 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 blah. And you know you're not. So you go to the emergency room. How many emergency rooms have we seen over the last several years closing in poverty-stricken areas? Emergency rooms, like the doctor's office, the first thing that you have to do is fill out the insurance information. If you don't see the insurance, if you don't do the insurance thing, you got a long wait. And especially in those areas where it's a high poverty area, we've already closed those emergency rooms. They're not there. See, when we had community hospitals and we said as a community, we need to make sure that hospitals are within a certain distance of, you know, a number of people so that for health reasons, if you have a heart attack, you can get to a hospital within a reasonable amount of time, maybe save your life, maybe just a thought. Until we started saying, no, we need these mega campuses. We need these massive hospitals that are, you know, miles long. That good luck figuring out how to navigate. We need these massive complexes. Instead of local community hospitals, we need big for-profit, consolidate, synergy. They're saying without the mandate, 40 to 42 million people would be left uninsured. That's in addition to the already nearly 50 million people who are uninsured today. They said government spending would only be 3 to 8% less on acute care for the non-elderly, partly because it would be paying more per subsidies per enrollee, and uncompensated care, which is unlikely to decrease without the individual mandate requirement. And this is one of those things that I've wondered about. Because Gingrich was one of the first people to be pushing this idea of personal responsibility and a mandate. See, because the Republicans, to their core, used to be, you know, individual liberty, individual responsibility. Somehow along the line, that individual responsibility thing dropped off, and it's now just my freedom and my liberty to do whatever it is that I want to do, and everybody else be damned. Or that's the way it appears to me. So that's interesting. We're going to see a 25% increase in our premiums, and I wonder then how they'll spin it. Now, understand, they're not going to be able to repeal it. I seriously doubt that. But it will be interesting to see what happens when it goes to the Supreme Court. And that's where I think the court has to start thinking maybe a little bit politically, like they did not do with Citizens United, because they opened up the floodgates there. So it will be interesting, which is, I just thought I'd bring that up. There's a new bill that is being proposed in Congress. Daryl Issa and Carol Mahoney, a Democrat from New York, have introduced a bill. And I look at this and I go, really? You're gonna nickel and dime me to death? Conservative world. Here it is. It's called the Research Works Act. And it's going to prohibit the National Institute of Health from requiring scientists to submit their articles to this online database. See, right now, today, we can go online and we can find all of these articles that are digitally archived at the National Institutes of Health. You can go right on the website, free of charge, read all about the latest discoveries, the latest medicines, the latest diseases, all free of charge today. Well, they want to add a fee, anywhere from $15 to $35, because, well, you know, the publishers, they need to make a little bit of money. But I paid for this study. It's my tax dollars that paid for this. Shouldn't I have access to it? They're saying no. They're saying that we should have to pay for each one, which is one of the things that drives me nuts in doing research. When you look at a lot of scholarly articles that are published, you look at these university professors who write papers, and you have to pay or subscribe to get access to them. It drives me insane. But I look at the stuff that I pay for, and I think we should have access to it, which is why I'm against this piece of legislation. But they're claiming, well, you know, we need to keep the people going who are doing the online part. And I'm going, nonsense. We should be paying for this. And again, this is very elitist. They know, people like you and me, we don't have the $15 to $35 a pop to look at a study just for general information. This is the commodification of information, of knowledge. I think back to Ben Franklin, the guy who, library. We need to have information and knowledge available for everybody, which is why he was a big proponent of public libraries and why I am as well. I look at this as another way of holding the keys to the kingdom and dangling them in their face, saying, sorry, you can't have them. A class action lawsuit filed on Wednesday is accusing Walgreens and the generic drug maker Far Pharmaceuticals of overcharging a number of generic drugs, just, you know, fatten the bottom line. The complaint filed by the UFCW, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and their pension fund and their health and welfare fund, the largest, I guess Walgreens is the largest drug chain. They violated racketeering laws, allegedly, by charging more. And I'm going, is that possible? We're already paying retail. So we're paying retail for the drugs, and now they're charging more? Yeah, evidently. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes. And this is why you need to have watchdogs. This is why you need to have people overseeing this. But I stop and I think back to that day. Oh, I remember it well. Yes, Billy Townsend, congressman from Louisiana, twisting some arms, getting those votes in order so we could pass that prescription drug bill so that we could pay retail, because we were Americans. If nothing else, we pay retail. We're proud of the fact that we waste money on drugs, while every other country in the industrial world does what we say we like to do, which is competition and, you know, the market, the free market. Not us. No free market, no capitalism here. Socialism. We socialized the risk of the drug companies. We made sure that the drug companies were well taken care of. And the rest of us, all the rest of us, well, you're basically on your own, brother, because you're going to have to come up with the payment. My aunt just sent me her insurance information for the new year, and for their prescription drug plan, almost doubled this year. Why? Reasons like this. More profitization for the cheaters. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to play a couple interviews from when we were up in New Hampshire that I thought were interesting. Jimmy Tingle, the comedian of the United States, running for president, and Rick Tyler, the guy who bought the movie on Bain Capital. Stick around. Right back after this.
Never been on welfare, that's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The new year is off to an old start. Workers rallying at state houses to defend their rights. Jesse Russell has more.
2012 is starting off much like 2011 with images of concerned citizens filling state houses. This year, instead of the images starting in Wisconsin, they are starting in Indiana, where workers are opposing a Republican plan to turn the state into a so-called right-to-work state. The legislation would ban businesses and unions from writing contracts that would require employees to pay dues to the unions that represent them. Last week, members of the NFL Players Association challenged legislators to vote against the legislation, as they considered it an attack on workers. This week saw Oklahomans standing with their Indiana counterparts, detailing how right to work has had a negative impact on their state. Jesse Isbell is an Oklahoma worker.
There is no anecdotal or empirical evidence that right to work has benefited Oklahoma state economy in any way. The truth is, it has driven down wages.
Oklahoma was the 22nd state to pass the legislation. Since that legislation passed, manufacturing jobs continue to move to Mexico and overseas. The most recent company to pack up was Bridgestone Tire, where Isbell was an employee of 36 years.
When you think of medical helicopter pilots, you may not immediately think union. But Dan McDade is a MedFlight chopper pilot who is also president of OPEIU Local 109, affiliated with the Professional Helicopter Pilots Association. This is the most challenging time of year for pilots who must keep an irregular schedule.
The pager, the tones can go off at, 2 o'clock in the morning, and usually, like 2 and 3 in the morning when we have to go fly. That's kind of like the most dangerous time, only because it's hard to get any kind of a sleep cycle where we shift from days to nights and things like that, so. And you're on for 12 hours at a time. So we do have crew rest issues.
McDade says unionized pilots have a voice on the job, a critical voice when it comes to safety.
The guys doing the job needed to be a factor in controlling their safety. Most of the safety improvements that have happened because of the unions that have brought those safety changes and made them happen. If a federal regulation needs to happen, it is not usually the company that is lobbying Congress to make it happen. Usually it's the unions.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO and by ULICO, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jimmy Tingle!
Thank you! Thank you! Thank you! I hope I have your support, November! I hope I have your support, November! I hope I have your support! I hope I have your support! Give me some money!
Politician for once. Jimmy Tingle for president. At least you're honest, Jimmy Tingle. I got Jimmy sitting here with me. At least you're honest. Give me some money.
Give me some money. That's right, baby. The name of my party, Humor for Humanity. Humor for Humanity. Humor in helping. Humor in healing. Humor in hope. Ha, ha, ha.
There you go. And not ideological. We're not running for Republican or Democrat. We just want to laugh and have a good time.
That's right. And that's what people chant at my rallies. Ha, ha, ha. So if you hear something, Rick, in the course of this interview that resonates in your soul and moves your spirit, let it rip. Ha, ha, ha.
I wish more politicians had that attitude.
And I will respond, yes, you can.
So you're going around the country, you're doing your comedy shows and in the Pat Paulson tradition.
In the great tradition of Pat Paulson, yes. And what I'm doing is I'm actually raising issues the other candidates aren't talking about. I mean, I have ideas that they're just not talking about. Every state in this country needs money. Every single state, okay? Under a Tingle administration, you're from Pennsylvania, right?
Yep.
Do they have toll booths in Pennsylvania?
They sure do.
Okay, under a Tingle administration, I will take the toll booths from the middle of the state, move them to the perimeter of the state, only charge people coming into Pennsylvania from other states. Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, wherever you're coming in, welcome. Welcome to the great state of Pennsylvania. This is a cover charge. It's $10 to come into Pennsylvania. Enjoy yourself. We have a beautiful state. You want to leave? $20.
Because I was going to say, it's like New Jersey. You can go into New Jersey.
Yeah.
You got to pay to get out.
That's right. You got to pay to get out. That'll raise money right there. Plus, in Pennsylvania, we'll have a 2-drink minimum.
Well, and that's interesting because we're talking about privatizing the state wine and spirit shops. So maybe, you know, like when I grew up in Ohio, you can have the drive-thrus where they hand you a single can of beer and they may even open it for you.
That's right. Well, and this is what we'll do. To get money off the sales tax, we'll have a 2-drink minimum. All right, that'll take a little tax there. You have to eat twice. That's a couple of meals taxes. Plus, you got to stay in a hotel. It's a hotel tax. So you got to stay 2 days once you get into Pennsylvania. $10 to get in. You got to stay 2 days. $20 to leave. That will balance the budget in a matter of months.
Now, will there be any entertainment, or is that up to the locals to put that out? Will Jimmy Tingle be there to sing and dance and do the whole?
What I would love to do, maybe you can recommend some theaters to show my film at. Jimmy Tingle's American Dream. I was very, very pleased to see your bumper sticker of proud defender of the American Dream, the Rick Smith Show. That's awesome because the name of my film is Jimmy Tingle's American Dream. It's airing on PBS stations right now around the country. So what I would love to do, come to Pennsylvania, show my film, do a little Q&A after it, then launch into Tingle for President, the funniest campaign.
And we can go, ha, ha, ha.
You can go, ha, 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 and I'll say, yes. You can.
So what kind of response are you getting from folks? I mean, are you getting people who are saying, well, you're just a comedian, it's just a joke? Or are you actually able to engage in some actual discussion?
What I want to use my campaign for is I want to use entertainment as a means to a larger end. So even if I'm not on any ballots, but let's just say you wanted to do a fundraiser for a theater there in Pennsylvania. I would come in, we could do the show, split the proceeds, the theater makes out, I make out, and I can continue my campaign. They can continue with their theater. So you're using it as a process to a greater goal than just the performance. That's one of the things I love about what I'm doing. And I have ideas that other candidates aren't talking about. My alternative energy plan, for example.
Let's hear
okay?
it.
Okay? Well, they've been arguing about the wind farm off the coast of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Are you familiar with this?
Yes,
argument?
I am.
10 years they've been arguing about this wind farm. I want to grab these people. This is America. There's lots of windy places. Do we have to put all the windmills off the coast of Cape Cod? Why can't we put some of the windmills in the breakdown lane on the highway? Look at all that untapped wind. Now think about this. Using wind generated by foreign oil to turn little windmills, to create electricity, to reduce our dependency on foreign oil. Do you see why I have to run, Rick?
I'm there. You're thinking outside of the box.
Way outside. None of the other candidates are coming up with this. And here's the beautiful thing about the Tingle campaign. I have more. Under a Tingle administration, I will mandate a little windmill on every traffic light in America to generate the power to run the traffic lights. Red, yellow, green. Red, yellow, green. Red, yellow, green. Now, the other candidates attack my ideas. Gingrich. Oh, they all attack my ideas. Candidate Tingle. What happens if one day the wind doesn't blow? You don't have to stop. Do you know how much gasoline we waste waiting for those damn lights to change?
Yeah, and both of your ideas tell me you're from Massachusetts.
I'm from...
Along with your accent, but... Yeah. In my opinion, as a truck driver for a number of years, Massachusetts has the worst drivers in the country.
Absolutely. We are proud of it, too. We have streets. This is why we have terrible drivers. Our streets are all crooked because they were based on cow paths. So if the cow went over here to get a drink of water, that's a highway.
The cow
went over there to go to poop, that's another highway. So you got the cow has laid out the streets of Massachusetts.
I tell my wife in Massachusetts they've got thumb turn signals.
Yeah.
They stick their thumb out and they turn the wheel.
Yeah.
And that's how they turn the turn signal.
Exactly.
On.
Exactly. It's a funny state. The people are they're pumped up on the coffee. They're going down the old cow paths. They're listening to talk radio. They're having a ball. They love their sports. They love their politics. It's the land of the Kennedys. And people say to me, well, Jim, you're from Massachusetts. It's a very liberal state. Could somebody from Massachusetts actually be elected in 2012? I say, that's right. I am from Massachusetts, and I'm proud. I'm from the land of the pilgrims, okay? I'm from the land of the revolution. I'm from the land of the abolitionists. I'm from the land of the Kennedys and the neighborhood. Hoods of Tip O'Neill, Cambridge, Massachusetts, God's country.
There you go. Are you from the area where that guy, what was his name? Paul something.
Paul Revere.
Warning shots and bells.
Paul Revere.
Yeah, doing the
British are coming. The British are coming.
He was warning the British with firing shots and right. Ringing the bells.
You're getting mixed up with Sarah Palin.
Oh, that's right.
You know what's funny? All the candidates are funny, but Herman Cain.
I miss Herman.
Oh my God.
Cheesy Dwarf was the absolute best.
Oh, my God. He was, we don't need a Rita in the White House. We need a leader in the White House. Hey, you don't want a Rita? Good. Get Sarah Palin. She can warn the British. The pizza's coming. The pizza's coming.
Sarah. What I loved about Herman, though, is, you know, here's a guy who and played to the simple-minded.
Yeah.
No bill will ever be longer than 2 pages. You can read it over dinner.
That was beautiful. And you know what's funny about Sarah Palin? Well, she would be very effective in the Middle East. She can see the pyramids from her house. And Herman, though, he was the greatest. He would say things like, my 999 plan. He would insist that if you add a 9% sales tax to a product that has no tax, that would decrease the price of the product. I don't know, Herman, the Congressional Budget Office says that if you add 9% to a pizza that has no 9%, that has no sales tax, it's going to increase the size of a pizza, the cost of a pizza. I do not agree with your analysis. It's not my analysis. It's the Congressional Budget Office. Well, that's why we do not want the government in math. The government does not belong in math. Math should be between you and your family.
No, but my fourth grader, she understands that.
Yeah, she does. But, of course, he dropped out because of the sexual harassment charges. But he kept the Secret Service just in case his wife tries to kill him.
And she may. But he's also keeping the book tour going.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw the Solutions Revolution bus tour he's on now.
He's hilarious.
The guy's a gift that keeps on going. I was really hoping here, when we came here, we'd be able to talk to Michelle Bachmann and Cheesy Dwarf.
Well, you know what's funny about Michelle Bachmann is that you're a very committed lady. Whether you like her or not.
She should be.
Very, very committed lady. She's got 5 children of her own, and she has over 20 foster children. If just her family voted for her in Iowa, she could have won.
She could have, but she didn't live in Iowa. She lives in Minnesota. I'm right next to John Wayne Gacy. So let me ask you, as you're doing this, what kind of feedback are you getting from people? Are you talking about substantive policy things?
Oh, sure. I just did the Concord. I just did the Concord Auditorium here in Concord, New Hampshire. That was a lot of fun. We showed the film, did the Q&A, did the actual campaign. Yeah, and people say, well, Jimmy, how are you going to do this? How are you going to have the Tingle Alternative Energy Plan? How are you going to enforce it? What I'm going to do, how are you going to fund it? That's what the big question is. I'm going to broaden the definition of national defense, okay? Broaden the definition of national defense. Healthcare, a form of national defense. Education, a form of national defense. Alcohol and drug treatment, a form of national defense. As we speak, there are millions of Americans that need and want alcohol and drug treatment. They can't get into the treatment centers because they're overcrowded or they don't have the insurance. But at the same time, we spend billions of dollars to put nuclear warheads on submarines and move them around the oceans of the world. Under a Tingle administration, I will build submarines for alcoholics and drug addicts who want help. I'm talking about underwater treatment centers.
There you go.
You can't check yourself out. Picture it. Thousands of Americans getting clean and sober underwater.
Now, would you put that on TV?
Absolutely. At the same time, we can be utilizing them in the war on drugs. They could be out there patrolling the coast as well. If a suspicious vessel's out there, looks like I'm maybe trying to smuggle drugs into America, the submarine
could
pull it over. The submarine could pull it over. If there's drugs on the boat, these guys will find it. And that's the Tingle difference. Ha, ha, ha.
I'm right there with you. Jimmy Tingle's American Dream video and also his CD, Jimmy Tingle for President, the funniest campaign in history, Humor for Humanity. Where can we get this stuff online?
You can get that at jimmytingle.com. JimmyTingle.com, just like it sounds. I'm also on Facebook, and believe it or not, I'm on Twitter. And I'm sure you guys are on Twitter, too. I don't personally don't know how it works. All I know is that a lot of people are following me, which I love. So if you want to follow me, I'd love that. It is a little odd, though. I got a tweet 2 days ago from a guy named Josh. This is Josh. I'm following you. Let me just say something, Josh. If you're listening to this interview, you're creeping me out.
It is kind of creepy with this whole I'm following you stuff.
Yeah,
and the other part of it is, you know, I spent all these years learning how to spell and use grammar.
Right.
All out the window.
It's all out the window. But I'm like, I do try to punctuate and everything, capital A's, capital B's, dashes, commas.
No,
I can't do anything with 104. People look at that and go, this must be spam. It's spelled correctly. It's got to be spam.
Excellent, excellent. It would be great to have you come down into our area.
I would love that.
And do some kind
can
of...
Can you recommend a theater off the top of your head? You can any venues that come to mind?
Well,
would
the Carlisle
be good
Theater, where, you know, in my neighborhood is...
The
is
Carl
nice,
Allen?
Carlisle.
Carlisle Theater. How many
home
seats
of the Army
is that?
War College.
Oh, really? How many seats?
I think they've got about 1,000.
Wow.
It's
that would
nice,
be great.
It's a nice old theater.
If I come down, would you help
place
me promote it?
I would absolutely do it.
I would love to do that. Maybe you could host it.
That might be an idea. Something
you can introduce
talk about,
me.
Something we could talk about after the program. Jimmy Tingle's The American Dream, and also Jimmy Tingle for President, the funniest campaign in history, Humor for Humanity. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Jimmy Tingle's name. Taking you right there. Jimmy, great talking with you.
Great to talk to you, Rick.
I can write you in, right?
You can write me in. Hey, listen, Gingrich, you know, if Gingrich can do it, he and I, we differ. He's very good. He's very smart. He's very accomplished. We differ on the issues. I'm a big supporter of gay marriage. Newt feels that marriage should be between one man and up to three women. And that's where we differ.
There you go. Jimmy Tingle, thanks so much. Great talking with you.
My pleasure.
Quick break.
Thank
right
you.
Back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Bars can get in legal trouble when they overserve patrons who then get a DUI citation. But what about retail outfits that contribute to SUI, shopping under the influence? Luxury stores, art galleries, and such have long used booze to stimulate sales. They pour free wine and other libations for their high-end customers, hoping that a lubricated shopper will be less guarded and more willing to reach for that platinum card. But the New York Times reports that the tactic of getting shoppers buzzed has now gone mass market, especially among online retailers. As one of them gleefully put it, post-bar, inhibitions can be impacted, and that can cause shopping and hopefully healthy impulse buying. Great. Our society has advanced from alcohol-induced sex to alcohol-induced consumerism. In either case, the morning after can be a downer. Take the guy who quaffed a tub of beer one night. He stumbled home in a stupor and, stupidly, went online. When he awoke, he learned that he had bought a $10,000 motorcycle tour of New Zealand. Internet retailers say there's been a boom in night traffic. Ask if boozy buying splurges might be sparking the increase? An eBay executive exclaimed, "Absolutely," noting that eBay's busiest sales period in every time zone is 6:30 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. He happily summed up the reason for this. When people get home from work in the evening, it's decompression time. The consumer's in a good mood. This is Jim Hightower saying, Barack Obama should jump on this. We're told that to get America's economy moving again, consumers need to buy more stuff. Forget trying to pass a stimulus package or a jobs program. To stimulate, inebriate. Just send everyone a credit card, a book of drink coupons, and a list of late-night online marketers.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com here in Manchester, New Hampshire. I'm sitting here with Rick Tyler. He is the The guy who did the movie When Mitt Romney Came to Town, kingofbane.com. We'll put a link over at the website. He's also with the Winning Our Future Super PAC. Rick, thanks for taking time for me.
I'm glad to be here. I don't want to take full credit for making the movie. We bought the movie. I didn't make it.
Oh, you bought the movie.
I wish I could say I made it. It's a great movie, but I didn't. We bought the movie.
Tell me, what's the premise of the movie? I understand it's from the Gingrich camp's perspective, or
well,
where?
it's actually, you know, we have the front runner Mitt Romney in the Republican presidential nomination process. It's ironic, but there's a lot of background opposition research about Mitt Romney, but very little about Bain Capital. And he had been there for 20 years, and yet very few people can tell anybody what Mitt Romney did at Bain Capital other than what Mitt Romney says he did at Bain Capital. Now, his central premise for running for office is to create jobs. He says, I worked in the private sector for many years. I'm going to create jobs. And, in fact, he said in the debate yesterday afternoon that he created 100,000 jobs. Well,
he said that again.
Yes, he did.
Again, and that's
yes.
The thing that he keeps with that talking point, even though it's been repeatedly disproven.
Well, you know, he might have created 100,000 jobs, but they weren't American jobs.
A good point.
They were probably jobs most likely in Mexico and Southeast Asia and overseas, because that's where the jobs went, and that's where a large amount of the equipment went that his companies raided.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, it's interesting when you see Republican going after each other. I'm pretty happy in that scenario. But especially when you're talking about somebody like Romney, who was part of the go-go 80s, part of the corporate raiding that went on, part of the fact that we're losing pension funds, all of that stuff. He was really in the middle of that. And does your movie go into any of that?
Yes. I mean, that is the whole premise of what, you know. Look, I'm concerned from a political perspective. He's saying he creates jobs. We learn things in the private sector about creating jobs. There are millions of people out of work, and people want to get back to work. And Mitt Romney is saying that he created jobs, but his record stands in stark contrast. He did not create jobs. He systematically destroyed jobs. And look, I'm not anti-free enterprise. I'm a capitalist. I'm for free enterprise. But this is not free enterprise in any sense of what people commonly understand.
Right.
You know, you have Bernie Marcus, who made Home Depot, for instance. People go to Home Depot because they like Bernie's products, and they bless him with dollars to exchange for those products, and he creates jobs for people, and people go to work there. That could be true of Steve Jobs at Apple, Jack Welch of GE, the Koch brothers. There's lots of people who make, but this is not what Mitt Romney did. In fact, it was interesting that Donald Trump said that he wasn't a businessman, he was a financier, because Donald Trump, you know, owns and runs businesses. Romney didn't own and run businesses. He leveraged buyouts, and he was acquiring companies that were vulnerable. These were mostly mom-and-pop manufacturers.
Absolutely.
And what he did is he went in and, in an effort to cut costs, quality suffered. And then he cut people's pension, rate of pay by like $2 and $3 an hour. So, and then he loaded the company up with debt. And then when he loaded the company up with debt, they charged obscene management fees. And
but isn't that all the Wall Street way? I mean, you can go beyond Bain Capital, and virtually all of the venture capitalists during the 80s and 90s ran that gauntlet.
You know, none of this of what I'm describing is illegal. It's all legal. I don't think
that's the problem.
Well, I don't think it's ethical, and I don't think it's moral. And I certainly don't think you can make a case for running for president on that model.
I agree with you.
And so.
But I also say that, you know, what you're talking, well, we hear a lot of, especially the Ron Paul libertarian type, saying, well, there should be no rules. But that's what happens when you have no rules.
Well, I'm not trying to engage in an argument about the virtues of capitalism.
Okay.
I believe in capitalism. We're 4% of the world's population. We create 25% of the world's wealth. Why? Because we have unleashed a system of amazing creativity and innovation, and a lot of that has to do with competition. And we have the best workers in the world.
But that also has a lot to do with government supporting an infrastructure where that happens. An education system,
absolutely.
A highway system, a communication system.
Of course.
All of those.
And those
things
are the things that the government should be doing. And we should allow entrepreneurs who invest, and investment is good, and who go after a profit, and profit is good, where they can create companies to create more jobs. But that's fine. And if Romney had a record like that, then I might support him. He doesn't.
Okay.
He has a record of systematically destroying companies. He wasn't a free enterprise in the sense that people understand it. It was more like a predatory corporate mugging.
I'm right there with you. One of my biggest knocks against him is exactly that. In fact, on one side of his mouth, he's saying he created jobs. But one of his partners, if I don't remember his name off the top of my head, said, I didn't know we were creating jobs. I thought we were making money.
They were making money for their investors. And look, when we invest in Wall Street, and many union members are invested in pension funds that are invested in stocks and mutual funds, and that's all good. That's part of the system. But they want to invest in things that grow value, that grow jobs over time. So that produce things. And the American worker wants to produce things. Mitt Romney was actively finding companies and putting them out of business. And, you know, let me just give you a G.S. Steel in South Carolina. He went in there and, like a scavenger, and picked apart that company. Now, those workers had pensions. Those workers retired with less money than they were promised.
Yep.
Now, I don't know, but I think most people, if you say to a worker, this is your pension, this is what you're promised, and then you retire with less than those pensions, and at the same time, look, if the money's not available, it's not available. But how did Mitt Romney and Bain Capital profit tens of millions of dollars from that same deal in which workers lost their pensions?
Yeah, but let me ask you this, Rick Taylor. Rick Taylor, he's part of the movie when Mitt Romney comes to town, Bain, kingofbain.com, the website. We're going to put a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Rick Tyler's name. It'll take you there. He works for the Winning Our Future Super PAC, correct?
Yes, sir.
You know, when you in talking about the things that you're saying here, to me it says that we have a lack of regulation. And for 30 years we've heard in this country we need to deregulate, let the market decide. Well, the market has decided that the best way to do business in this country is to do exactly what Mitt Romney's done, because the guy at the top, he's the guy who makes the money. I mean, is that,
I think
as you've laid this out.
I think we have some common ground there. I think markets, I don't believe in complete deregulation because there has to be protections for things that are just wrong. I mean, this is not free enterprise in a sense. I just call it wrong. I'm a defender of free enterprise. I won't defend somebody raiding a corporation taking workers' pensions at a profit. You won't defend that, but if Mitt Romney wants to defend it, and that's what we're asking him to do. Look, go do a press conference. If all this is explainable, let the press ask you questions about Bain and answer the questions. But, you don't think, I'm sure you're well aware that Barack Obama and David Axelrod and the Occupy Wall Street movement is more than willing to ask these questions of Mitt Romney if he makes it to the general election. If he can't survive this vetting, then he shouldn't be our candidate.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say that Axelrod and Obama are in any way have anything to do with the Occupy movement. I won't go there, but
he's a community organizer.
Have you been out to some of the Occupies? They're not big Obama fans.
I haven't. I should walk across the street.
You're
right.
You should go talk to them.
I'll do it.
So let me ask you this.
Yes,
you know, as we're going down the road here, even if you take Romney's statement at face value, he's created 100,000 jobs. The jobs that he says he's created, Staples, he says he created 89,000 jobs. Sports Authority, he created 15,000 jobs. And Domino's Pizza. Are those the jobs we really want in this country? Is that the economic vision that we have, a completely Reagan-esque service-based economy where we produce really nothing of value?
Well,
we're just stores.
Well, and look, I come from a retail background. You know, stores are great, and
we
love those jobs.
But you also
too.
Need value-added manufacturing.
We need to build things. You got to make
absolutely.
Things, and you got to manufacture things. So when Romney goes in front of you and says, you know, we need to bring manufacturing from overseas, the reason manufacturing is overseas started with Mitt Romney.
Absolutely, and that's the point I think I want to get across, especially about Romney, because I do believe he's going to be the inevitable nominee.
Not if I can help it.
And that's why you're here. Who else is better than Romney in your opinion? Because you know, I look at each candidate. I look at John Huntsman, who I just asked a little bit ago. If we're going to have country first, can we have country first in trade policy as well? And he walked by the question. But you know, each candidate seems to be free open borders, free market.
Well, I worked for Newt Gingrich for 12 years, and I studied Newt Gingrich. He ran as a Republican. He's a movement conservative from Georgia. He ran in Georgia in 1974 when you couldn't get your trash picked up as a Republican in Georgia. And he did get elected, and he helped Ronald Reagan with his economic policies, and I think the record is very clear about job creation in the 80s. He brought the Republicans to the majority for the first time in 40 years. He balanced the budget for 4 years in a row. He cut spending $405 billion. He got welfare reform passed. Bill Clinton signed it. And he cut taxes. And all the while, 11 million jobs were created while he was Speaker. Now,
he was part of that. Let's not give him too much credit. He was part
Bill Clinton signed
the
balanced budget, and he did sign welfare reform, but he didn't write the bill, and at first he vetoed it. So I think without Newt Gingrich, you didn't get those things. But I'll give President Clinton his fair share of
that. In the 80s, if you want to talk about that, a completely different era. Our trade policies were completely different. We had not gone down this insane path of neoliberal trade, where we're going to be the only nation to open up our borders and allow a country like China to just not even steal, just be given our manufacturing capacity.
Right, and we have no ability for our products to get into China. I mean,
yeah.
China should be our customer, and yet we've borrowed money to China to pay for oil to people who don't like us. I mean, look at the energy potential in the United States. Look at all the jobs that can and have been created, for instance, in North Dakota with this idea of fracking. We have so much energy in the United States, and yet we don't want to exploit that for our own national security, because industry runs on energy. And
in bringing that up, Pennsylvania, going to be a big fracking state very soon. What do you do with the environmental problems that it causes?
Well, look, there's
can we learn nothing from the coal industry?
Well, there's always risk with extracting natural resources and fossil fuels in particular. But I think over time the industry has proved pretty safe. And yes, you have to have safety regulations and you have to have environmental regulation. But the way the environmental regulations are rigged now, I mean, they just have a chokehold to not allow companies to go and extract oil, which we like cheap gas, we like cheap coal, we like cheap energy, and to create jobs.
That's interesting because, you know, this president has put forth the fewest regulations of any in recent history, and there are numerous opportunities for people to be drilling. So I'm not, some of the experts that I'm talking to, they don't have that view that you seem to have. So where's that coming from?
Well, why are we not allowed to, you know, Barack Obama goes down to Brazil and says, hey, we'd really like to be your best customer. And yet we have more energy resources here in coal and natural gas.
And we're doing mountaintop removal. We're basically flattening off West Virginia. Have you been to some of the mountaintop removal sites?
Yeah, I live in Loudoun County, so I'm not far from West Virginia.
You okay with that?
I'm okay with responsible environmental practices to get energy and coal.
Beautiful. So let's get back to this real quick, quick minute. You know, in looking at the jobs numbers, you know, are these the jobs we want to be creating? What Bain Capital has done, the type of destruction of our manufacturing base, is this the direction we want to be going?
We want to create lots of different kinds of jobs. You know, I got my first job as in McDonald's, and I learned a lot from working for McDonald's. I got my work ethic there, but I didn't stay at McDonald's, and I eventually moved up. I still admire McDonald's, and I admire the service industry jobs.
But I
agree with you. We do need manufacturing jobs. We need them here in the United States, and we do not need to continue to follow this model where we push jobs overseas. We got to figure out how to put American workers to work, but in a free market society, and in my opinion, a free trade society.
Let me ask you the last question I've got for you. The Republicans have pursued this no rights at work agenda, this whole anti-NLRB, anti-union rights agenda. Is this the right direction for the country, in your opinion?
I believe in right to work, and people should be able to join unions at their will or
another Republican. Spoken.
We're doing so well.
Rick Tyler, I appreciate the time.
Hey, thank you so much.
The movie is When Mitt Romney Came to Town, kingofbain.com. We got a quick link. We got a link there. Quick break. Back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
Today, spider brains. The brains of tiny spiders are so large, they fill their body cavities and overflow into their legs.
Researchers at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama measure the central nervous systems of 9 species of spiders, from rainforest giants to spiders smaller than the head of a pin. As the spiders get smaller, their brains get proportionally bigger, filling up more and more of their body cavities.
The researchers said that the smaller the animal, the more it has to invest in its brain power in order to be able to perform fairly complex behaviors, like, in the case of spiders, weaving a web.
They discovered that the central nervous systems of the smallest spiders fill up almost 80% of their total body cavity, including about 25% of their legs.
Some of the tiniest immature baby spiders even have deformed, bulging bodies. That bulge contains excess brain. Adults of the same species don't bulge.
Brain cells use a lot of energy, so small spiders probably convert much of the food they consume into brain power. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. For more on this story, come to earthsky.org and search on the words spider brains. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So, as we talked about last week, House Bill 1580 up in the great state of New Hampshire, the Granite State, where we spent a good portion of the last week for the Republican primaries. They've got three Republican representatives who have decided that it'd be a great idea to make sure that every piece of legislation that goes through the New Hampshire legislature has to find its origins in the Magna Carta. Now, the Republicans in the U.S. House, they wanted to go back and make sure everything was grounded in the Constitution. Well, these three, they wanted something a little older. They wanted to go all the way back. They said their primary motivation was the honor of the nearly 800-year-old document. One of the guys said, well, he probably needs to bone up a little bit on it, but said it might be a good idea to learn a little history, and says the document still functions. He also said that it's a little bit older than the Constitution, but the same thought is there. So I thought I would ask somebody who is an expert on the Magna Carta to come and talk to us. That's why I've asked Professor Peter Linebaugh, a professor of history out at the University of Toledo. He's also authored the book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. Professor, thanks for taking time for me.
You're welcome.
You know, I look at the three representatives up there who want everything to be grounded in the Magna Carta. Is that something that's workable?
Well, it might be. It depends on what they mean by Magna Carta. Magna Carta contains the phrase the due process of law or law of the land. So that is as vague as total jurisprudence itself. If you follow me.
Okay, so
or if they meant something more specific, then they're putting some meat into their dish.
Yeah, I think their opinion is that the idea of freedom that the founders got to put into the Constitution came directly from the Magna Carta. That's what I'm hoping their thought was.
Yes, the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment also contain this expression, due process of law, which derives from Magna Carta. Magna Carta itself has 63 chapters to it, each chapter just being a line or two. And the 39th is the one that's most famous around the world. And it's the one that provides habeas corpus, prohibition of torture, trial by jury, and due process of law.
Something I think we're all in favor of.
Habeas corpus has been challenged, of course, at Guantanamo and elsewhere. Trial by jury and prohibition of torture have also been under threat, as increasing numbers of people are willing to countenance torture. But if the House Bill 5080 in New Hampshire wants to hold by Magna Carta, then they need to hold by those provisions which have meant so much in the history of liberty throughout the world.
So the Republican attacks on workers' rights, not something covered, not something that the Magna Carta would put up with.
No, I don't think it would. And this brings us to another issue. The Magna Carta is quite strong on what it calls the commons. Its seventh chapter calls for commons for widows, and the Magna Carta itself means big charter, because there was a little charter that went along with it. That's the Charter of the Forest, which had to do with common subsistence rights for commoners in the main energy resources of that time, which wasn't petroleum or oil, but was forests.
Interesting. So, my mind's spinning here because, you know, this is, you know, the people who put this forth, I'm sure, are not people who are interested in the commons being available for all. As I've seen, you know, that party particularly talking about anti-redistribution policies and you know, winner take all. That's kind of, if I'm getting this right, the antithesis of what Magna Carta would have put forth.
Yes, I think that's a fair reading. Both New Hampshire and Pennsylvania and many parts of the United States have strict licensing arrangements for hunting and game laws, and these derive from a notion of the commons in marshlands and forest land and so on. So that law is not completely dead. By any means, this notion of the commons.
So, you know, in looking at this, and at first you go, I thought it was just a political stunt. The idea being we're going to go back into history and we're going to show you that we're smarter than everybody else. But there's actually some things in this that functional today, even though back then you were talking about a feudal system, correct?
Correct.
So you're talking about a king and the servants. This is the relationship between them, a little bit different than today, correct?
Yes, in some ways.
Or maybe not.
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I mean, the gap between the rich and the poor in the United States is growing, and the gap between the rich and the poor in 13th century England was vast, with a chasm. But the importance of Magna Carta was that the civil war which resulted from that gap found a peace in Magna Carta. Magna Carta was a kind of an armistice, not just between the king and the barons, but between the entire ruling elites, the barons, the church, the king, and peasants and commoners.
So they were no longer talking about income inequality in quiet rooms.
Right. Right.
I mean, because you look at what Mitt Romney said the other day. We should talk about it, but just in quiet rooms, where out of the public view, I guess, is the idea. And I guess in thinking about this a little bit more, I guess you could maybe draw some parallels. Maybe we need something new, and maybe these three are on to something that maybe we should be moving forward on. Maybe a new modern era type Magna Carta.
I think so. And the person who agrees with you is Tom Paine. If you read his Common Sense, which was written in February 1776, in a really cold winter, Tom Paine said that the American colonies needed a Magna Carta, and the Declaration of Independence was written as a result of that suggestion. And the Declaration of Independence, like the Magna Carta, held the right of resistance to be sacred.
So civil disobedience and going to your government for redressive grievances, those type of things.
Yes, the right to resist unjust authority was guaranteed to all.
So in Magna Carta, is the corporation covered there? I mean, are they protected? Are they a ruled class?
The corporation, as we understand it, is not protected in Magna Carta. We should say right away, Rick, this Magna Carta has been used in a lot of different ways in the United States. At first it was used, for example, by Justice Taney in the Dred Scott decision in order to show that persons were property. And then Magna Carta was used after the Civil War to show that property was persons. So on the one hand, it was an instrument that the U.S. Supreme Court alluded to in the transition from a slaveocracy to a corporate state. state.
Interesting. Because the more I'm thinking about this, maybe they're onto something. You know, because, you know, originally when I think Magna Carta, I think the things you said first, which I think you said was Chapter 39, habeas corpus, right, and the due process and those things. But this could be much deeper than just the joke that I think they thought it was, you know, just to get headlines.
Right. This is why I wrote this book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, because actually it is quite deep. And it is, there's much in it that we can learn from, much in it that, but the Magna Carta is as a living document, as living law, needs us to use it.
See, now that right there is, I think, where you lost them. Because I don't think they believe, like the Constitution, I have, most of my righty friends don't believe it's a living, breathing document that changes with the times. They believe it's only what's written. If it's not specifically written and delineated right there in black and white, it's not possible and it's not changeable.
Well, when you come to scholarship, this always poses problems because the Magna Carta was lost for a few weeks, and then it was found again. And then there were 17 copies of it, and it was in different languages and has different translations. So when you say something is written down in black and white as being permanent and eternal, as soon as you look into it, you find out that even that is not the case.
Yeah, nothing's permanent or eternal. So let me ask you this. You know, as this concept of the commons, something that I firmly believe in, I believe in we the people. I think that we should own, you know, our parks and our roadways and things like this. Kind of the complete antithesis of what, you know, people who brought this bill up, what their party is pushing for, which is privatization and private ownership of everything in our country, education, health care, you name it, the ballot box should all be for profit and privatized. Again, completely going against what they've proposed.
Yeah, I think Magna Carta is not a document that would support either profiteering or privatization. Magna Carta is mainly concerned with community, and it's mainly concerned with constituting society of different classes in a way that guarantees, that maintains subsistence at least for all. And of course, in our day and age, we expect more than subsistence. We also want health care for all or education for all. We regard these as human rights.
Yeah, see, you brought up that class word. See, Professor, we're a classless society, haven't you heard? They've gone to great lengths to tell us we're a classless society, but we care about the middle class. Not quite sure about the messaging there, but we're a classless society, but we care about the middle class.
Well, it's patently not the case. I mean, people can say what they wish, of course, but the United States is a deeply class-riven society and always has been. And the way that those classes interact, whether you're speaking of slavery and the slavocrats, or you're speaking of immigration, or you're speaking of Asian people coming to America to build the railways, or East Europeans coming to build the steel and dig the coal, we've always been a class society, and from the struggle between the classes come some of our greatest freedoms, especially the ones you were mentioning. Some of these come from Magna Carta, and some of them came from the U.S. New Deal, for example. But even then, you know, our Social Security, the Wagner Act, and even the Universal Declaration of Human Rights owes things to Magna Carta. And when you look at the origins of those, whether Social Security or UN Declaration of Human Rights, they acknowledge this debt to Magna Carta.
Interesting. And the book is Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All, written by Professor Peter Linebaugh. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com of where you can put this up. Because I'm starting to think maybe I need to get on board with this. Maybe I need to contact the three guys up there in New Hampshire and lend my support where we can. Because, you know, now the more I'm hearing about this, this could actually be a good thing in helping workers and helping families and helping we, the people, move forward.
It could be. It's very much a we the people document, and has been used that way throughout history, English and American history.
Is there any downside to this? I mean, there's got to be a downside to this where there's got to be something in there to protect the corporate form or the hierarchy to, you know, to make sure the king's well taken care of and living on the plush. There's got to be something there.
Sure. There's 63 chapters in it, and I've referred to two. But there are many of them that are that back up the hierarchical society that you mentioned. But there's another point that if the king disobeys any of these provisions, then he must pay reparations. So their notion of justice is not only a prohibition, but is an active notion, and that dues must be paid, reparation must be paid for harms done.
And penalties. Wow, that's a much better. That's a much different scenario than our corporate kings and masters. They get away with bankruptcy, and we end up paying that bill too.
That's the truth.
Very interesting. Again, the Magna Carta Manifesto. I got to find this book because maybe this is a good idea. This is a very good. We got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Professor Peter Linebaugh's book. I appreciate your time, sir. Thanks so much for the information.
My pleasure.
I'm going to get on this. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider it is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Our quote of the day from Ann Thacker and Elizabeth Williams in their piece, Unequal and Unstable. They write, "The history of the past century reveals a striking correlation between income inequality and financial crisis." So, you know, the wider the divide, the more unequal a society we have, the more and deeper type financial crisis we have. The more power they have at the top to influence law, to influence policy, and guide the direction of the nation, the more often they're going to crash the economy, the more often they're going to create crisis. Because understand, they benefit wildly from a crisis. You know, like I think it was Rahm, like I think it was Emanuel, and a couple other people have said, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. Because there's plenty of opportunity. And look what's going on right now. They're back. Wall Street, back. The bonuses, back. The investor class, happy. Couldn't be happier. What's going on with you and me? Wages are going down. Benefits are being taken away. At some point, we have to wake up and realize this. And I look at this GMI research poll study. Since 2000, so in the last 10 years, according to GMI research, we have seen 21 CEOs here in the U.S. Pocket severance packages worth at least $100 million. So we've had at least 21 of these CEOs who have gotten, call them what it is, golden parachutes of over $100 million. Now, what's interesting is those CEOs, they averaged only 13 years with the company that they were working for. 13 years. I mean, that's almost as good as the guys over here at the Capitol who after 10 years get health care for life and long-term health care. Not that crummy stuff you get. But $2,100 million apiece. And you got to wonder, what was the performance? Because I think of Robert Nardelli, who has got to be one of them. $210 million they handed him when they fired him. He tanked the company. And because he had a contract, they wrote him a nice check for $210 million. And within a couple of months, he had the job as CEO over at Chrysler. I mean, that's good work if you can get it, man. I think he was only there a couple of years. That's a good gig if you can get it. But evidently, these are things we can only talk about in quiet. Because those people, they don't understand. The rabble just doesn't understand. You know, we just...
You can't handle the truth!
We just can't handle the truth. And most of us, you know, we walk through our days saying...
I know nothing, I see nothing, and I say nothing.
You know, because... they're so much better than we are. They're so much smarter. Which is why the brain trust of the social conservative movement are heading to Texas this weekend. They're marching orders anybody but Romney. They're not happy with his social stance. They're not happy with really any of his stances. So you got people like Tony Perkins, who's the head of the Family Research Council, who may attend, may not. He's not happy, though. Unsure of the meeting will produce a unanimous agreement. Who do they spend their money behind? Do they go behind Rick Santorum? Do they get behind Gingrich? Do they get behind a failed Perry? Do they pick up Huntsman? Or do they pull someone out of the stands? Or is it too late? Is Huckabee too late? Probably. But they're looking for their social conservative. They're looking for that Santorum-esque character. And Santorum's doing what he can to rile the base. He was out today. Again, the speech was just fantastic. He's going after Obama, you know, saying that Obama wants a constitutional amendment to redistribute wealth. That's what he wants. The exact quote was, remember the President of the United States saying when he was running for office early in his career, he was asked the question as a constitutional law professor, what change would he make? What deficiency was there in the Constitution? And his answer was there should be a provision to redistribute wealth. Well, that's what he wants to do. So I spent about, you know, a couple of minutes looking for that kind of a statement out of the president. What I found was a statement from a radio interview he had done in 2001 where he was talking about the civil rights movement and the victories and the failures and all the litigation that went into this and how the Supreme Court never really ventured into any of that. And he wasn't taking a position one way or another. He was saying that, you know, people have said that the Warren Court was really radical. And the fact that they didn't get into that, those basic issues of, you know, politics or economy, and this idea of redistributing wealth shows that they weren't that radical. But again, you've got the, you know, this mainstream corporate controlled media, you know, just the, you know, the stenographers, if you will, not vigilantes for truth. And maybe, you know, maybe Mayor Linda Thompson's right. Maybe what we need are more vigilant vigilantes. Maybe we need people out there doing more stuff. But here again, you know, it would be nice if we had a mainstream corporate-controlled media who actually, well, I don't know, did a little something. Quick break right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The new year is off to an old start. Workers rallying at state houses to defend their rights. Jesse Russell has more.
2012 is starting off much like 2011 with images of concerned citizens filling state houses. This year, instead of the images starting in Wisconsin, they're starting in Indiana, where workers are opposing a Republican plan to turn the state into a so-called right-to-work state. The legislation would ban businesses and unions from writing contracts that would require employees to pay dues to the unions that represent them. Last week, members of the NFL Players Association challenged legislators to vote against the legislation, as they considered it an attack on workers. This week saw Oklahomans standing with their Indiana counterparts, detailing how right to work has had a negative impact on their state. Jesse Isbell is an Oklahoma worker.
There is no anecdotal or empirical evidence that right to work has benefited Oklahoma's state economy in any way. The truth is, it has driven down wages.
Oklahoma was the 22nd state to pass the legislation. Since that legislation passed, manufacturing jobs continue to move to Mexico and overseas. The most recent company to pack up was Bridgestone Tire, where Isbell was an employee of 36 years.
When you think of medical helicopter pilots, you may not immediately think union. But Dan McDade is a MedFlight chopper pilot who is also president of OPEIU Local 109, affiliated with the Professional Helicopter Pilots Association. This is the most challenging time of year for pilots who must keep an irregular schedule.
The pager, the tones can go off at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, and usually, you know, like 2 and 3 in the morning when we have to go fly. That's kind of like the most dangerous time, only because it's hard to get any kind of a sleep cycle where you're, you know, we shift from days to nights and things like that, so... And you're on for 12 hours at a time. So we do have crew rest issues.
McDade says unionized pilots have a voice on the job, a critical voice when it comes to safety.
The guys doing the job needed to be a factor in controlling their safety. Most of the safety improvements that have happened because of the unions that have brought those safety changes and made them happen. If a federal regulation needs to happen, it is not usually the company that is lobbying Congress to make it happen. Usually it's the unions.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO and by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Thank you.
Smith Show. You know, I saw the Richard Cordry, the new consumer financial bureau policy guy, the Protection Bureau, had coming out and saying, well, you know, I talked to Tom Donahue, and we're going to have frequent conversations, and I'm going, do I have that kind of access to Richard Cordry where my, as the consumer, are my interests are going to be that protected as Tom Donahue, the head of the International Chamber of Commerce? Am I going to have that kind of relationship? And no. And why should he, I guess, is the bigger question. I thought Cordry was supposed to be the guy overseeing it. There's a group called Patriotic Millionaires for Fiscal Strength. They say that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce policies are bad for American business and bad for the U.S. economy and deeply harmful to capitalism itself. And that's why I've asked Chrissy Setzer. She is the head of the U.S. Chamber Watch, uschamberwatch.com, the website. Chrissy, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this this press release, and is the Chamber of Commerce, is what they pursue, destructive to capitalism itself?
I sure would say so. You know, look, you need to look no further than Tom Donahue's quotes himself last year at his State of American Business address. Now, this is a speech that he gives annually, and he talks about basically how the, you know, the state of American business is strong, but for all these wayward Democratic policies that are getting in the way. So last year he said the chamber's top priority is going to turn an economic recovery into a jobs recovery. So you would think that they'd spent, you know, all of 2011 working on policies that would actually create jobs. But in fact, the top three things that they pursued last year were one, the creation of the Keystone Pipeline, two, tax cuts for millionaires and big corporations, and three, railing against sort of needed regulations that obviously, you know, keep us safe. So none of these things, in my view anyway, seem to create a whole lot of jobs.
Yeah, but again, I mean, this is why I think we need to have a conversation of what capitalism is and what it does. To me, capitalism is the capitalists who have the money use their money to make more money. It's not about creating a better society. It's not about taking care of workers. It's not about any of that. It's about them profiting off of their capital, and it's about them. So when you say they go after the pipeline thing, which benefits them, tax cuts that benefit them, and deregulation that benefits them, I think the U.S. Chamber of Commerce did exactly what the capitalists wanted.
That's actually right, and this is clearly a view that he shares with, Tom Donahue shares with Mitt Romney on what the meaning of capitalism is. And in fact, again, here's another great quote from Tom Donahue. He was asked at that same speech last year, he said, well, what exactly do we need to do to create jobs? And, you know, this seems to be a pretty obvious question for, you know, someone that has a big J-O-B-S jobs, you know, banner hanging outside of their headquarters. And Tom Donahue was actually pretty surprised by the question. He was sort of stumped by it. And finally he said, well, corporations need to create a rate of return for their investors.
Ah.
That's what he said they should do to create jobs. So, I mean, this sort of gives you a view to how he views capitalism as well. It's not about workers. It's not about, who's actually collecting a paycheck. It's about fattening the wallets of the investors.
Yeah, I had someone tell me this past. We were in New Hampshire for 5 days over the Republican primaries, and I had someone tell me, look, you know, if jobs are created, that's great, but at the end of the day, it's about making me richer. It's about making the capitalist richer. And if society benefits, well, that's okay, too, but that's not our focus. Our focus is to make more money.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, again, what's more telling than the fact that they actually opposed the President's American Jobs Act, you know, which economists were saying would create about 2 million jobs. They opposed it because it would raise taxes on millionaires.
I think that's pretty telling. So again, I go back to this: why we should have this conversation is because we're being fed this line that capitalism is productive and capitalism is all this wonderful things. But you look at these big capitalists, people like Romney, and not just him, but he's one of them. These big equity fund managers and these big sovereign wealth funds. It's not about creating, you know, an economy for you and me. It's about making wealth for them. What we should be talking about is how do we have an economy that works for all and is still prosperous for people who are smart and work hard and all of those things that I don't think the U.S., or as I call it, the International Chamber of Commerce, is the one to be talking to. I think your local Chamber of Commerce, the people who plant flowers and spruce up Main Street so that they can produce a product that people want and create jobs that way.
That's right. Yeah, there's a big difference, obviously, between the U.S. Chamber, which is pretty much seen as, you know, an arm of the Republican Party and does share that view of capitalism that, you know, Mitt Romney in his tenure at Bain Capital does, which is, you know, while he was at Bain Capital, a lot of businesses went, you know, a lot of companies went out of business, but the investors did very, very well. That's, you know, that's not the view that most, I think, small businesses share of capitalism.
Yeah, I'm not against people making money. I'm really not. As long as we don't have children starving, we don't have kids going without education, we don't have people going without health care, I don't have a problem with everyone doing well, as long as everyone's doing better. So when you look at the Chamber of Commerce, because, you know, when I talk about the International Chamber, you know, some people say, well, you know, that's my local group. Tell me, I mean, are they interlined like most people think? Are they working cooperatively? How is this relationship between the international group that helps send jobs overseas to China and my local chamber down on Main Street? Is there any collaboration or what's going on?
In a few instances, there actually are. There's a few state chambers. Michigan is one of them, where they actually are aligned very closely with the U.S. chamber. They're sort of like mini U.S. chambers. And, you know, in these cases, too, they're very, very aligned with the state Republican Party. They're pursuing all the same policies as the national chamber is. But for the vast, vast, vast majority of cases, no, there's absolutely no connection between the local chamber and the U.S. chamber. There's something like 8,000 local chambers and something like 200 of them that actually have any affiliation to the U.S. chamber.
Do we know who funds the Chamber of Commerce? Do we know where their money comes from?
We do, actually. Now, they try very hard to keep this all secretive, but the great research team at U.S. Chamber Watch has been able to uncover some things by looking at their, you know, their 990 tax forms. And maybe the best illustration was actually in 2009. Now, we've looked at their 2010, you know, money as well, but in 2009, they had something like a $200-plus million lobbying budget, and only 16 different contributions made up more than half of that budget. And it's the company that you think it is. It's sort of, you know, in that case, that included in 2009 an $86 million contribution from AHIP, from the American Health Insurance Plan. So basically, you know, again, the big pharmaceutical companies that were working together to fund the chamber to try to kill healthcare reform. They also get a lot of money from, you know, the big banks and from financial institutions like JPMorgan Chase, Bank of America, who have been working very hard to kill the, you know, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and who wanted to fight Wall Street reform. And then there's companies that are just sort of like, you know, Caterpillar or Xerox, who do a lot of outsourcing, and they want protection from the chamber for those policies. So they also give a lot of money to the chamber. So it's kind of a, you know, who's who of who's damaging the economy.
And I would wonder, you know, I'm sure there have been studies done of how much return those companies get for their investment, you know, by having not only that lobby operation, the chamber there, but others, and how much money they got back in tax breaks. And I would wonder what the percentage of that the highest tax rate in the nation that those companies actually pay.
Yeah, you know, we did. It's funny. We looked into this a little bit into the you know, tax cuts for millionaires, and we looked at some chamber CEOs and looked at you know, what would they individually get? Like, what would Rupert Murdoch get, for example? From, you know, he's obviously, you know, runs News Corp, et cetera. They are very closely aligned with the chamber. What would he get from, you know, from extending the Bush tax cuts? And for the most part, they were getting something like, you know, sub $1 million, like something like $700,000 personally in their wallet just from this tax break. So even if they're giving, let's say, $1 million to the chamber per year to, you know, to fight on behalf of policies that fat in their wallets, well, that's a pretty decent return for them.
Yeah, we the taxpayers give them a nice rebate.
Yeah.
And again, I go back to, how do I get this? How does that work for me?
How do we sign up for that? Right.
No, because we keep hearing the same arguments. And I go back to the tax reform bill of 86. where Reagan went and said, okay, we're going to cut all these loopholes. We're going to start taxing workers who lose their job on unemployment compensation. We're going to take away all of these middle class tax breaks. But in addition, we're going to take away some of the corporate ones and raise everybody's taxes and lower the top people's taxes. And that worked for a couple of days. And then people like in the chamber and other groups went back to Congress and they got all of their pork back. But you and I, well, we're still being taxed on unemployment.
Right.
So it's good payoff.
It is a very decent payoff for them.
This is why we need lobbyists.
Exactly. 99% we need lobbyists.
If I had $87 million, I would hire a lobbyist. But evidently I don't. So that's why groups like yours, the U.S. Chamber Watch, and folks at Patriotic Millionaires for Fiscal Strength, you actually have a group of millionaires who are saying, look, we made our money because of public investment, right?
Right, yeah. Now, so Chamber Watch worked very closely with Patriotic Millionaires on this pushback to Donahue's State of American Business speech this week. We had Leo Hendry, who is actually also a Chamber Watch board member, but who is a member of the Patriotic Millionaires, say essentially, you know, what we've already said here, which is that none of these policies that the Chamber, you know, is pursuing actually create jobs. And the Patriotic Millionaires, their philosophy is, in fact, that, yes, you should raise taxes on millionaires because the best way to create jobs, to put more, for one thing, to put more money in the hands of, the 99% people who can actually consume products.
Yeah, people like me.
Right, and me.
And all of the other people whose wages have been going downward since this recession started. The website, again, fixtheuschamber.org. We'll put a link at thericksmithshow.com and also patrioticmillionaires.org. We'll put a link there as at thericksmithshow.com as well. Christy Setzer, always great talking with you. Keep up the great work.
You too. Thanks again.
Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Oh, 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Oh, 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Bars can get in legal trouble when they overserve patrons who then get a DUI citation. But what about retail outfits that contribute to SUI, shopping under the influence? Luxury stores, art galleries, and such have long used booze to stimulate sales. They pour free wine and other libations for their high-end customers, hoping that a lubricated shopper will be less guarded and more willing to reach for that platinum card. But the New York Times reports that the tactic of getting shoppers buzzed has now gone mass market, especially among online retailers. As one of them gleefully put it, post-bar, inhibitions can be impacted, and that can cause shopping and hopefully healthy impulse buying. Great. Our society has advanced from alcohol-induced sex to alcohol-induced consumerism. In either case, the morning after can be a downer. Take the guy who quaffed a tub of beer one night. He stumbled home in a stupor and, stupidly, went online. When he awoke, he learned that he had bought a $10,000 motorcycle tour of New Zealand. Internet retailers say there's been a boom in night traffic. Ask if boozy buying splurges might be sparking the increase? An eBay executive exclaimed, absolutely, noting that eBay's busiest sales period in every time zone is 6:30 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. He happily summed up the reason for this. When people get home from work in the evening, it's decompression time. The consumer's in a good mood. This is Jim Hightower saying, Barack Obama should jump on this. We're told that to get America's economy moving again, consumers need to buy more stuff. Forget trying to pass a stimulus package or a jobs program. To stimulate, inebriate. Just send everyone a credit card, a book of drink coupons, and a list of late-night online marketers.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Or you can give us a call here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So a lot of stuff around the anniversary of September 11th. And the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, also had a procurement. They purchased some 70,000 commemorative bracelets to hand out to their workforce. You know, kind of a nice thing. It's a nice gesture, don't you think? You know, here's something, you know, thank you for your service, you know, whatever. Problem. Well, they were made in China. And, you know, I go back to this and maybe it's because I do believe in nations. Maybe it's because I do believe in charity begins at home, and I do believe that we take care of, you take care of yourself first, your home first, your own land first, and then once you're strong enough to help others, you do that. And you do so generously. The problem is right now this nation is struggling. Manufacturing, we have lost the capability of manufacturing at the rate that we used to. China is now the manufacturer of last resort, and we are their consumer. And you look at the reality is this massive gap, like I said earlier, this massive gap, more trade deficits. We've had, you know, somewhat $500 billion in the past couple of years that we could have saved here at home had we just followed the Buy American legislation that's already in place. $500 billion. May not sound like a lot when you're talking about a $16 trillion deficit, but it's a start. And you look at over the last, our last trade surplus as a nation, as a whole, 1975. Add all that up. That's a lot of years of money going out of the country that's not coming back. Well, actually, it is coming back in the way of debt, because we have to keep borrowing this stuff, which is why there are a number of bills in Congress. One of them, the Invest in American Jobs Act, make sure that our tax dollars spent on stuff made here. I mean, the idea is, you know, when you build a road, does it do any good that the cement you use comes from overseas? When you build a bridge, does it do us any good if the wires and the steel are made overseas? Does it help us? You know, I go back to the cash for clunkers thing, which I was in favor of. I thought it was a pretty good idea had you done it right. Had you had higher mileage standards and had you had domestic content requirements, would have done a really good job of getting the economy moving, would have helped the auto industry faster. And look, the auto industry coming back. You know, not doing all right. We're starting to see some pickup. They're talking about hiring more people, more job creation. But if you remember, you go back, you think about Zach Womp.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson.
Look, they're going to hire another 6,000 factory workers in the next year, according to the latest reports, between Ford and Chrysler. They're going to have auto workers filling these plants, 650,000 of them this year. That's a good thing. And you got Zach Womp there. Well, you know what? Let them fail. Let them fall through the floor so we can buy more of that foreign product. And you know what's even worse? And I really didn't want to get off on a rant here about Zach Womp. But you know what's really disgusting to me? You got these people like Womp and like these Southern Republicans who spew country first. Country first! Yet they pursue policies that harm the country first. I mean, stop and think about the statement. You know, Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, right to work state, less wages, less health care. Advocating for a foreign company over an American company. I know, we're global citizens now, right? We're all global. We live in a global economy. Let me let you in a little secret. We've always lived in a global economy. It's just we were a little smarter about it in the past. We made sure we protected ourselves, made sure that our industries weren't burned and pillaged. You know, I go back to the magnet in our smart bomb. The Chinese literally came in and boxed up the only company in the U.S. that made the magnets that made our smart bomb smart. Boxed up every machine, crated everything up, shipped it back to China, recreated the entire factory. Like they just lifted it up and transplanted it over there. Now we're buying it from them. What's that say about us? And what does it say about this idea of capitalism? I mean, that's the conversation that needs to be had. We need to really define what capitalism is. Because when you get down to the bottom line, it's about money making money. It's not about a better society. And you look at you look at Bain Capital. If it wouldn't have been Romney, it would have been someone else. You know, he just came out with a new ad. I don't know if you saw this. He just came out with an ad defending his time at Bain Capital. And he's talking about this company, Steel Dynamics. And the New York and the Los Angeles Times had a little blurb on this as well. They bought the company. I guess they invested something like $18 million in it. And then like 4 or 5 years later, they sold it. They sold their part of it for $104 million. And then, you know, they lined their pockets. They got a nice, you know, $85 million in a short period of time. That's what these guys do. They invest in it for a little time. They tweak things. They make it so they can dump it off on someone else or suck the assets out of it. What they did, and this is the part that nobody's really gotten to yet. What they did in this case with Steel Dynamics is they went to the state and said, hey, we need some money. They went to the county and said, hey, we need some subsidies. We need some grant money for training. We need roads and bridges. We need workforce development. We need help with our energy. We need all of this stuff. Because that's the only way we can stay in business, is if you, the taxpayer, give us, the corporation, some money. And, of course, they did, to the tune of about $37 million. So you had all of this tax abatement, all of this development money, all of this stuff. The taxpayers of the county where this steel mill was, Steel Dynamics. The factory that it's in, or the county that it's in, the citizens actually voted to say, you know what, it is so important that we have those jobs in our community because it creates good paying jobs for the workers and helps all of the other feeder jobs and all of the people who own restaurants and bars and movie theaters and all of those things. Helps the community, keeps us propped up. They actually voted to have a 0.25% tax on all residents to help finance their infrastructural improvements. Stop and think about that. The people actually said, you know what, this plant is so important to us. It's so important to our lives. It's so important to our community that we're going to raise taxes to give to a private corporation so that they will be able to make a go of it. And, well, they sucked all of it out of it. And what ended up happening? They know what happened. So when I look at this, I go back to my argument about beggar thy neighbor economic development. Do we really need to be subsidizing these big corporations? I think about Carlisle Tire and Wheel, 93 years in that plant. And because there was a big payout by the taxpayers of Tennessee, while there was money to put in their pockets, they ran like thieves in the night. My next question will be, how long does it take them to move overseas? Because they've already moved once. They've got their bags packed. They have no ties to the community, no allegiance. The person who started it has no has no ties to the home. You know, you talk to people, when Carlisle Tire and Wheel was leaving, you talk to people who knew the guy who started it and the people who were instrumental in keeping it going at the beginning. They were community people. They were there. They were accessible. You knew who they were. And like Richard Eskow said earlier, is there no shame? And there is no shame because they don't have to look you in the eye anymore. These big capitalists, they don't see the people that are affected. All it is a line on a sheet. Maybe we need to start thinking about how we allow our economy to be run. And should the structure be the way it is? Should there be equity funds and these wealth sovereign funds and all of these that their only objective is profit? And if there's a job created, well, that's a negative effect. It's a necessary evil because it takes away from profit. Understand the business mentality. And that's what it is, folks. Your labor costs them money. Quick break, right back after this with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to save it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Earth, sky.
Today, spider brains. The brains of tiny spiders are so large, they fill their body cavities and overflow into their legs.
Researchers at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama measure the central nervous systems of 9 species of spiders, from rainforest giants to spiders smaller than the head of a pin. As the spiders get smaller, their brains get proportionally bigger, filling up more and more of their body cavities.
The researchers said that the smaller the animal, the more it has to invest in its brain power in order to be able to perform fairly complex behaviors, like, in the case of spiders, weaving a web.
They discovered that the central nervous systems of the smallest spiders fill up almost 80% of their total body cavity, including about 25% of their legs.
Some of the tiniest immature baby spiders even have deformed, bulging bodies. That bulge contains excess brain. Adults of the same species don't bulge.
Brain cells use a lot of energy, so small spiders probably convert much of the food they consume into brain power. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. For more on this story, come to earthsky.org and search on the words spider brains. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Want to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
It was great seeing you at the big New Hampshire primary, the Talk Radio News Service Radio Row. We had a fantastic time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, I had an absolute ball. And I look forward to doing it again the next time.
Well, we got conventions coming up, you know.
Working on going. So what's going on today in the Washington world? It looks like the president's, I talked a little earlier about this merging of agencies. The right's got to be going nuts over this.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's difficult for them to know exactly how to react to this because they don't want to give the president a win. But what he's doing is something that it's streamlining government. It is actually ultimately going to eliminate jobs, but the jobs are going to be eliminated through attrition, so nobody's going to be let go. So basically, when people leave, people will not be hired back. It's going to save $3 billion over 10 years, which is not a huge amount of money in the overall scheme of things, but it's still money. But it's going to mean that instead of, like, I don't know, I think there are something like 20 different websites, I don't know the number, and thousands of different phone numbers that if you're a small business you have to call when you want to deal with the government. There's going to be one website, one phone number, one department. And the idea is that it's going to be streamlined and simpler. Now, I don't know if that's going to be true, but that's the plan.
That is the plan, and like all plans, sometimes they don't actually work out. Because I'm looking at this, and these are some pretty big agencies that you're gonna try and put into one. I can't imagine how much information they're gonna try and cram onto this one website, and I can't imagine how long I'm gonna have to wait on hold if all of those phone calls are going to one agency.
I know. Well, I mean, this is very interesting. It's very interesting. Now, some things they're going to move because apparently a large amount of the Commerce Department's budget actually is used up by NOAA, and that's going to Interior. You wouldn't have thought the NOAA would be in Commerce, but it is, and so that's going to the Department of the Interior. That's moving.
Interesting. You know, and I'm looking at the merging of trade and commerce together, and my question right from the beginning when I saw that was, will there be a new focus on, since you do have commerce at home and trade abroad, will there be a focus on trying to, you know, even out our trade deficit, especially with a place like China, and maybe start to look at how do we enforce the trade rules that are in place instead of having someone like the steel workers who has to go out and do all the legwork on these trade cases and then set it at their doorstep and hope they act on it. Maybe, possibly, will they do it themselves?
Don't know the answer to that. I mean, there are an awful lot of unknowns at the moment, including the unknown of will Congress grant the president an up or down vote in 90 days, which is what he's asked for.
See, you would think that this
because he can't do it by himself. He has to have legislation.
Right. You would think that it would be something they'd be in favor of because, you know, the righties love that synergy word and consolidation and all. That's right up their alley.
But it's not as simple as that now because if the Republicans go on board with this, then they're giving the president a win.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to give the president a win. And so it's very difficult to do that. And it's a Republican argument. Government should be made leaner. So what do? Republicans have to, you know, either put themselves at odds with something that they believe in and let Obama win something, or explain themselves. And that's going to be very difficult, and they have to do that in the payroll tax fight. So it's going to be very interesting to see which way they'll jump on this. We've heard from a few leading Republicans, and they seem to be deciding to sort of position themselves carefully at the moment. But it's so toxic in Washington, particularly since the payroll tax cut, and now with the recess appointments, that, you know, you can't spit.
Yeah. Did I hear you say Republican Guard?
I did not.
Okay, I thought right at the very beginning you said Republican Guard, and I was going, yeah, I guess I can see them in that role.
I did not.
Okay. It just sounded like that. Maybe it was like Rick Santorum saying blah. Maybe that's what I heard.
I never.
Okay. I'm just asking. I just wanted to, for journalistic sake, I wanted to clarify. That's all.
Okay.
Overseas, it looks like another downgrade by the S&P.
Yeah, this is it's interesting. Some people are saying, oh, it's nothing because it's the weekend. That's why it was dropped. But actually, it's quite a big deal. Standard & Poor's stripped France of its prized AAA credit rating today. But not only France, it lowered the ratings on Cyprus, Italy, Portugal, and Spain by two notches.
Wow.
Those of Malta, Slovakia, Slovenia by one. It downgraded Austria also. So it downgraded nine countries in all, I believe. It did not downgrade Germany.
Well, I think Germany's doing pretty well, aren't they?
Yeah, Germany's doing pretty well. So, it downgraded a lot. Italy was lowered from an A to a BBB+. Not good when you get in the Bs.
Yeah, not at all. But Germany, like I've been saying for the longest time, they've got smart policies. They worry about what's going on at home. And then they help out abroad when they can, but they take care of their people at home. Maybe something we should consider, looking at the trade deficit numbers that we have, since we just decided that we don't want to manufacture anything in the U.S. anymore. Let's just send it overseas.
It's a thought.
That's a thought. So what's on the agenda for the campaigns going on in South Carolina? A lot of craziness going on. Santorum had a great statement about Romney, kind of like he's the boss. And do you really want your boss running for the presidency?
Interesting that he said that, because it reminded me of what Mike Huckabee said 4 years ago, you know, which I thought was even more pithy. But Santorum, you know, it was not bad, because Mike Huckabee said 4 years ago, you know, he's the guy who laid you off.
Yeah.
He's like the guy who laid you off.
And Romney actually is the guy who laid you off.
Exactly.
But, you know, for me, what it said to me is it said that even Santorum understands that there's a difference between the boss and everybody else, because he went on to say that, you know, we need the voters, you know, because, you know, you can't have that conversation with the boss. So we need voters to, you know, to be able to have that conversation. And to me, it showed that even he understands there's a difference.
I'm still not over, because we didn't talk yesterday. I'm still not over him saying to Matt Lauer that you could only talk about income inequality in quiet rooms. First of all, he said you couldn't talk about it at all. But then when pushed, he said you could talk about it in quiet rooms. I'm still walking down with my jaw on the floor.
Because you're jealous. That's what it is, Victoria.
I'm jealous. I am. I'm jealous and envious.
You know, I don't know that I'm really jealous. But, you know, I do think it's not a good thing for a nation to have this kind of inequity. Because, you know, to be honest, I have pretty much everything I could really want. And I don't want to live in his world. I'm happy in mine. But I wouldn't say I'm jealous.
I want a MacBook Pro.
Okay, well.
I want a MacBook Air.
Okay, well. It sounds like
I can live without it.
Maybe if you went to Mitt in his quiet room, maybe he'd give you one.
That sounds slightly dirty.
I did not mean it for that at all. I'm just, the quiet room comment caught me. We should be talking about these things in quiet rooms.
Yes, and which, of course, makes you think of clubs.
Okay, sure.
Gentlemen's clubs.
I didn't go there, but okay.
Yeah, it makes you think of clubs that you only get into if you're privileged.
Now, that sounds a little dirty to me, gentlemen's clubs.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of the British idea of gentlemen's clubs. Clubs that you only get into if you're privileged.
Well, isn't that the world that they live in, though? I mean, really, honestly and truthfully, when they talk about being a classless society, and then worried about this thing called the middle class in the classless society. Doesn't it kind of highlight that?
Yes. Yes.
I've always found that quite humorous. And finally, the Kansas Republican House Speaker. I believe it because I've seen the bumper sticker, but I will allow you to elaborate.
Okay. Well, this is, of course, last week he was forced to apologize to First Lady Michelle Obama after he forwarded an email to fellow lawmakers that called her Mrs. Yo Mama and compared her to the Grinch. But earlier that week, the Lawrence Journal World was sent an email that he's forwarded to House Republicans that referred to the president in a Bible verse that says, "Let his days be few," and calls for his children to be without a father and his wife to be widowed. And this is Psalm 109, which is a prayer for the death of a leader. And it's, "Let his days be few, and let another take his office. May his children be fatherless, and his wife a widow. May his children be wandering beggars. May they be driven from their ruined homes." And it goes on. "May a creditor seize all he has." Anyway, O'Neill forwarded the prayer with his own message. "At last, I can honestly voice a biblical prayer for our president. Look it up. It is word for word. Let us all bow our heads and pray. Brothers and sisters, can I get an amen? Amen." And he refuses to apologize, saying the message was only referring to Obama's days in office.
Oh, and his children plundering and you know, the fruits of his labor being plundered, and his children, you know, wandering beggars and ruined home and all that. You know, that didn't, again, this is one of those things that gets me about the Christian people, the good God-fearing people. Not very nice, not very friendly, not very good, in my opinion.
when you do that kind of stuff, there are other psalms you can forward.
But these...
Psalm 23 is a nice one.
Okay. And that is?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot now.
Well, no, I mean, there's a lot of them. I think of Matthew 25, which is a nice story. I think of a lot of the New Testament
stuff. Yeah, Psalm 23 is, you know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
Okay, there's a good one.
He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. That's nice.
That is nice. And maybe that's the Christianity I would like them to pursue. Maybe not the one that the Republican representative in Tennessee threatened to stomp a mud hole in somebody who's transgender.
Yeah, that's a little unfortunate.
I'm sure a good God-fearing Christian. But there you go. Anyway, Victoria Jones, always great to talk with you. It was great seeing you up in New Hampshire. Look forward to talking to you again.
Look forward to it very much.
Talk, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitative use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So I've seen that bumper sticker in a bunch of places, and I actually, it's been a while. I've seen this. It's been months now, probably at least a year that I've seen it. Not just you've got a representative dumb enough to come out and actually say it. But, you know, like she said, Psalm 109 says, let his days be few and let another take his office. May his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. I don't know how you can, that part, I'm not sure how you can say, I'm not wishing him ill. May his children be fatherless and his wife be a widow. That's pretty right there. May his children be wandering beggars. May they be driven from their ruined homes. That's a good family values kind of thing, don't you think? May a creditor seize all he has. May strangers plunder the fruits of his labor. May no one extend kindness to him or take pity on his fatherless children. To me, that seems to be the antithesis of what Christianity is based in. And I find it hard to believe that the good God-fearing Southern Christian person would stand for something like that. But look what we've got, man. Look what we've got. It's absolutely mind-blowing. Good news, Rick Perry and Newt Gingrich and Santorum and John Huntsman, they will not be on the March 6th Virginia primary ballot. The only people who have the organization and the resources to get enough signatures to get on the ballot were Mitt Romney and Ron Paul. So the question, I guess, happens in Virginia. The Republican Party has a pledge that they want every primary goer to sign. If you don't sign the pledge, they want to ban you from being able to vote. You got to love Republicans who say, well, we want you to have the right to vote only if you vote our way. So Perry's lawsuit, along with, of course, Gingrich's, Santorum and Huntsman's, not happen. The judge threw it out, refused to add their names to the ballot because they didn't follow the rules. Now, what they wanted to do is they wanted the rules to be thrown out so that they could be on the ballot. And, you know, I looked at this and I go, March 6th, that's kind of a ways down the road. That's pretty optimistic of the Gingrich, Santorum, Huntsman clan, especially given the fact that really they're not going to have the money. They don't have the organization. That's pretty optimistic. You got to give them credit at least for that. So there you go. I got this press release, and I love these press releases that these crazy people send me. It's a worker advocate challenge constitutionality of Obama's controversial labor board recess appointment. A worker advocate. The National Right to Work Committee, that National Work Foundation, they're not a worker advocacy group. They're a corporate front group. Their job, push the no rights at work agenda. Make sure workers don't have the right to join a union. That's what their job is. And to be the little ankle biters who, when you find one or two malcontents who want to pursue something just because they're mad about something, they take advantage of that. So it's always amazing to me when they say they're a worker advocate group. They're anything but. But they are well funded. Well funded indeed. Reuters had an interesting story today. They had this guy who's the head of the San Antonio Tea Party. A guy named George Rodriguez, which is kind of interesting to me if you think about it, that a Hispanic guy is the head of the San Antonio Tea Party. When most of the Tea Party people you talk to are viscerally against immigration. I want to get those brown people out here. Round them up. Drive them back out. But he was preaching to this Texas Public Policy Foundation forum. And he was saying, you know, when we use the word conservative, people are more responsive than when we use the word Republican. Because the word Republican to Hispanics means kick me out of the country, ask me for my papers, harass me. But conservative sounds so much better. So again, trying to change the language, and they're good at that. They're really good at changing the language, the discourse, and repeating it, staying on message time and time and time again. So I think we're gonna probably see more of this. They claim that the Hispanic community is somewhere around 50.5 million. And they are the largest minority in the U.S. So you got to go, how do we bring those people in? Well, the conservatives are looking at starting a bunch of right-wing Spanish talk shows. They're looking at trying to get some maybe Limbaugh in Spanish or Hannity in Spanish. And they got the money to do it. I'm sure that they will find somebody because, after all, they found George Rodriguez, who was more than willing to shill for them. I don't know. I just don't know. Can't wait for the weekend. Looking forward to this weekend. And for most, it's a three-day weekend with Martin Luther King Day on Monday. We will be here live in the studio to take your calls and talk about what's going on, especially what's going on in Wisconsin. I don't know if you saw the news from Wisconsin. Scott Walker has been accused of violating over 1,000 campaign finance laws, mostly for the fact that he has not someone gives him $100. I guess he, according to this report, he's putting in his pocket, not reporting, not disclosing. They found this one Wisconsin Now group found Walker had violated the state campaign finance laws 1,115 times. That's an awful lot of money. And it'd be nice to know where it went and who got it. Maybe it went to the cell phones that they were finding child porn on. Maybe that's where it was. And I was talking to John Nichols, who was, when we were in New Hampshire, he was saying what's even more funny about the whole thing, not funny, more ironic about the whole thing, is his aides were using phones and the technology from one of his campaigns from years past, from like 2002. They had kept that stuff up and running because who's going to check that and who's going to know about it? And that's why it's going to come back to Walker, hopefully. And maybe he's indicted before he's recalled. Or maybe they indict him just before the recall and the recall happens. That would be very interesting. But a funny story I saw, evidently his campaign staff has put up billboards across the state that said Scott Walker creating jobs. And you got these creating jobs for Wisconsin or something like that. And they got these big billboards. They placed one right in front of the closed GM factory there, and I think it was Janesville. That's great messaging, don't you think? I'm thinking someone's probably going to get fired for that. And if they don't, you got to wonder how incompetent Walker actually is, because I don't know if the Koch brothers are going to come in and run it for him, or Alex going to come in and run for him, or you know the billionaire class is going to do his work for him. I do not know, but I'm told the money is flowing into Wisconsin. Earlier on, someone told me that he could raise $70 million, which is why I think the email I got from Bernie Sanders to get involved with this amendment to pursue overturning Citizens United. Bernie introduced this constitutional amendment, Saving American Democracy. The idea is to say that corporations do not have the same constitutional rights as human beings, and that people have the right to regulate corporations, along with the fact that corporations should not be making political contributions, and Congress and states should have the ability and the power to set reasonable limits on election spending. Personally, I've always been a big fan of publicly financed elections. I mean, that really shows the executive power. That really shows the decision making in my mind. And what you do is you throw in some free airtime, free radio ads, free TV ads. As a matter of, it's our airwaves. This is part of the public good, the commons. Maybe we should be pursuing that. But he has a pledge place where you can go and sign up for the pledge. The one I got was from Democracy for America. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Click sign up. Be part of it. We should be making sure that people like Karl Rove, who has pledged to spend $240 million, at least has to disclose where that $240 million came from. You know, at least. I don't think I'm asking for too much, do you? I don't think it's too much to ask that when there's a message on TV that tells me that Obama's a dirtbag or Romney's a dirtbag, that I know who's doing it. Honesty. That's all. Pretty simple stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of our program, thericksmithshow.com, the best place to go to get our podcast. If you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. This weekend, I am looking forward. My daughter's back on the court. The girls back playing basketball this weekend. One team, I'm 3-1. One team, I'm 2-1-1. So the coaching career, the next phase of my existence, or at least for this season, going pretty well. I'm pretty excited for them. And it's really, for me, it's really remarkable watching people, watching these kids grow and experience something. I mean, that's what's rewarding, and that's what I think being part of a community is about. And that's the kind of country that I want to have. That's the kind of community that I want to have. Not hooray for me and screw you, but all of us together, in this together for a better tomorrow, a better opportunity for our kids, and a better opportunity for ourselves. This idea that capitalism creates jobs, capitalism creates more money for the wealth class. That's what it's meant to do. And just because it created a job, well, that just happened. Anyway, have a great weekend. We will see you back here on Monday. If you missed any portion of the show, again, therickSmithShow.com or Stitcher, Stitcher, Stitcher. See you Monday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the bitter sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.